It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show, on Friday the 8th of October 2021, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft here in Bristol, and also at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Tonight, the COVID passport in Wales. Neil McEvoy describes the sneaky way in which it was put through and what he believes actually is now utter corruption going on in the Welsh Parliament. He calls it now, it's not a parliament, it's a little club where everyone helps each other out. Also, BBC hatchet job on our much-loved Bath doctor, Tess Laurie, from the evidence-based medicine consultancy, who's worked for many years for the World Health Organization, for the National Health Service. But all that, of course, is lost on the BBC. They don't mention any of that. They say that ivermectin is some sort of dangerous drug. It's a stupid drug to think about, to use. We talked to the investigative journalist Sonia Elijah about why ivermectin is not actually, as the BBC are saying it is, some sort of horse dewormer. It's actually a very important medicine that's been used for decades and saved millions of human lives. It's the BBC just lying to us there again and trying to get rid of the idea that people might like ivermectin in a rather tardy, tawdry fashion. Also, the Nudge Unit, a fascinating insight from Professor Matthias Desmer over in Belgium. He's a clinical psychologist looking at the way this Nudge Unit has been forcing us to do things without us even realising it, by using fear and by pressing our unconscious buttons to get us to do what the pharmaceutical industry want us to do. And he talks about the whole COVID thing as a kind of spell. Fascinating guy. And he's done very well. He's from on the Pandemic podcast recently, and that's actually become, in just a space of a very few days, the most listened to edition of the Pandemic podcast. Also, our resident immunologist, Dr. Stanley Laham, gives us his view about this whole idea of vaccinating children. But first, before all that, we've got a Sweeney theme on, and we're going to start by looking at looking at the Sweeneyan and the dramas of the 1970s and 80s, comparing them to today, with a guy called David Wicks. Now, he was worked for ATV Television, he was one of the directors that worked for that whole stable of Euston Films, which was the film arm of Thames Television. So he went from ATV to Thames, and he talks to us about, you know, his experiences there, and also how he fell out with Hollywood. He was working a couple of years ago over in Hollywood, and he describes how things were, and compares it really to the golden days of TV drama, when much money was being spent and great talents were being brought together to create dramas, to persuade everybody to buy a TV, to get it in their home and to watch week after week. And we're going to start with that in a minute, actually. But also, we'll be talking after that, of course, about this week's Conservative conference. Boris taking about £1,000 away from every person that has to claim universal credit. And in the meantime, upping gas bills by about £1,000 too, just to make sure that they can't afford to live, that they can't afford to buy toilet paper, that they can't afford to pay the rent. And this is obviously couched in jolly terms. Of course, we'll be hearing Boris's jolly speech about how he's rubbing the poor's nose in the dirt. And also, of course, from Carrie, his wife, a little speech by her. It'd be interesting to see what she had to say. So looking at those gas prices too. Also, one of the big stories of the week is the Pandora Papers. They always got to come up with another word for these. The investigative journalists that have put this together, the team based in Washington, D.C., is part funded by the Soros Foundation. It's really not WikiLeaks, and it's trying to do a similar sort of job that WikiLeaks was doing, but only it's not really doing the same thing, is it? It's only dishing dirt on certain people. A little bit of dirt dished on Tony Blair, but nothing really. He's not done anything illegal. There's no massive surprises in here. So we get the view of the outgoing director of the Tax Justice Network, John Christensen, probably one of the world's great authorities on tax dodging and what can and should be done about it by the super rich. So also South Wales police corruption, a bit more on that. It almost seems to be a running theme, doesn't it, on this programme, not just South Wales, but generally police corruption. And why one particular victim by the name of Maurice Kirk believes there is no actual oversight of South Wales police at all. So they can do pretty much whatever they want if they've got the sanction of a few corrupt senior officers and nobody's going to touch them. Also, the Bristol Palestine supporting sociology professor David Miller, an exclusive interview with him. He's just been sacked last weekend from his job as a sociology professor at Bristol University. Although, actually, as he explains in the interview, it's nothing to do with actual anti-Semitism. So we'll find out what it is about today. Also, finally, a little visit to Alex Craner. Alex has been on this show many times, based in Monaco, hedge fund manager, and he's doing his own regular podcasts now, thankfully. He looks at the fascinating links between the Theranos scandal. This is this company in California, in Silicon Valley, that promised that it could, it managed to attract massive investment with all sorts of powerful people like Kissinger, etc., on the board, that it was going to take a drop of your blood and then give you a quick diagnosis. It sounded like a great idea, but it just didn't work. And what Alex explains is why he thinks it didn't matter that it didn't work. The actual company was set up for a different purpose, to actually start to bring people round to the idea that this kind of thing might happen. It didn't matter that their actual equipment, the scientific lab's equipment to do it, to find out what was wrong with people from this drop of blood, didn't work at all. It was a complete and utter con from start to finish. And Elizabeth Holmes is currently on trial in the United States for fraud. But anyway, Martin, I think we better start with the we'll do the Sweeney in a minute, but let's do the gas prices first, because this is a massive whammy. That's finally we've got a figure, £1,000 a year extra people are going to now be having to pay on our gas prices, and the Russians are being blamed.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not just in Britain that there's an issue with gas prices, obviously, but the lead news on BBC radio both today and yesterday was the US claiming that the Russians are trying to manipulate the situation in order to try and control Europe, etc., etc.
Well, yeah, but they are, aren't they? Because of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, as that comes on stream, the Russians want the best possible price for their gas as they switch it on.
Well, obviously, the Russians are going to want to be paid for their gas. What they are saying is if the EU regulators make their mind up to say it's okay for us to switch the gas on.
So they still haven't been allowed to switch the gas on, even though the thing is connected.
No, because there's still some bureaucratic
paperwork.
Oh, well, God. You know, basically, as you know, the Americans have been very unhappy about this from the get-go, as have the Baltic states and the Poles, the US allies. The Germans, basically, particularly the industrialists, who are behind the scenes, you know, quite a powerful in Germany, want Russian gas. And Europe as a whole is...
Well, it could half the cost of industry.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean,
Russia, of course they want it.
Russia has been supplying gas to Western Europe and Eastern Europe for decades. And effectively, I mean, it's to do with geographical integration. Obviously, if the Russians have got loads of gas and industry in Western Europe needs it, then there's an obvious solution, which is
The Russians want their euros and
That's
their
right.
dollars too, don't they?
That's right. And, of course, there's been huge opposition to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Poland and the Baltic states, because, of course, in other circumstances, the pipeline could have gone through Poland and the Baltic states and they could have had a cut of it. But because they are so hostile to the Russians, as Manfred Petrich pointed out, the Germans and the Russians have decided to set up a pipeline which takes it straight to Germany, which doesn't cross any other countries, so that, for example, the Ukrainians can't hold the West to ransom, saying you can't have Russian gas unless you do X, Y, and Z. And, of course, the Ukrainians and some East European countries, which are particularly hostile to Russia, have been very opposed to Nord Stream 2. I believe the British government has been opposed to Nord Stream 2, but, of course, the Germans basically regard it as their prerogative to do deals with the Russians
so
if they think it's okay.
As these nations start falling out even more, so people here just got to pay more to cook up their boiled egg in the morning.
That's true, but of course, if Nord Stream 2 comes online, which is what the Russians are suggesting, then that will increase the supply in Europe and therefore stabilise the market and ultimately, in the long run, bring the price down.
Look, coming down to brass tacks here, because the idea that suddenly it's become more expensive to get gas out of the ground is just simply not the case, is it? It's the same price as it was 6 or 8 months ago. What's happening is that the Russians are coming into this market, and the, for example, the North Sea. I was listening on talk radio to Dale Vince from Ecotricity talking about this. He's saying that the North Sea producers have just jacked the price up because they can.
Well, that's what happens when you've got a shortage. That's what happens automatically. It's what you'd expect from an economics textbook, isn't it? If you're not going to ration things, the only way to ration things is by price. And if people want to buy it, then there's more demand. And if the supply is constrained, then the price will rise. Now, the problem with things like gas is there's this illusion of a kind of free market.
Don't they create a shortage? Can't they just simply create a shortage?
Well, they could, in theory, create a shortage.
And it may be that the French have created a shortage, by not piping gas underneath the channel.
There doesn't necessarily have to be anybody to blame for a shortage. The shortage is to do with the fact Nord Stream 2 could have been completed years ago and could have been already in operation, and that would have prevented a shortage. But because
it hasn't, Martin, I just don't buy that at all. I mean, Nord Stream 2 is going to be a load of extra gas that on top of what we had before.
Yes, and that would lower the price. And Nord Stream 2 has been blocked.
So maybe they're upping the price just because they're scared that it's about to drop.
The Russians aren't upping the price. The Russians
Our Nord Stream producers are upping the price because they know the price is about to drop.
That's right. So they are basically doing what, you know, rational market agents do.
Yeah, well, this is
in a situation
obvious,
like this.
An obvious.
They charge the price the market will take.
An obvious example to bring this back into public ownership. We need to do that.
Well, in actual fact, all of these energy infrastructures are in public ownership. In places like France, Russia, etc. It's only in Britain. I mean, look at what's happened in Britain, where all these absolutely silly little energy companies, which were basically set up to provide the illusion of a market, and as soon as the price goes up, they all go bust, and then people are left with no supplier, which then means that the government has to step in and solve the problem by paying money to the existing big suppliers to take on these small people, the customers of the small people, because the market doesn't work, which is why all of these things were initially in the public sector. British Gas was set up when Britain discovered oil and gas in the North Sea, and British Gas was owned by the British government, and there was a long-term plan for how much gas they were going to pump. They're not taking any profit other than necessary profit to reinvest, and therefore you can make a plan about what you're going to do. But we don't believe in having a plan in this country. The market decides.
Actually,
until the government has
surely
to come
what,
and sort
what this
it out.
Whole market thing is about, it's about divvying up this massive infrastructure which is guaranteed income to your mates, isn't it?
That's it. That ultimately is what it boils down to. Do you remember Tel Cid, the whole thing about selling off British Gas? And British Gas's shares were sold at a fraction of what they were actually worth, to the great advantage of the Tory voters in marginal constituencies, who bought the shares and then immediately made a fat profit, which then, of course, made them much more willing to vote Tory than they already were.
Well, it was selling off the family silver, weren't they? What we've seen now is we've got three of the rail companies now back in public ownership and public control. So maybe the government is being forced to buy some of this public family silver back.
Well, as they used to say in the Soviet Union, reality feeds back. You know, ultimately, these things, the government has to actually step in and control these markets. It's much better if they actually own the infrastructure. But, of course, what's happening now is they're paying catch-up and trying to make a plan on the hoof, incidentally, which, of course, means putting public money in the hands of private shareholders again, who've profited so enormously from the mess the first time. This is the fruit of the 30, 40-year experiment in free market everything, which was begun in this country in 1979. And, of course, it doesn't work, which is why that's why it was all in the public sector in the first place. Basic stuff, completely forgotten. The railways, they go bust, the state has to step in and sort it out. Might have been better not to privatise in the first place, waste all the money.
We'll talk to, we'll hear from the Tory conference with Boris and Carrie after, I think is appropriate now, after we discuss this whole idea of people making an absolute fortune from shareholdings, etc. and the privatisations from John Christensen. He's just the outgoing chair of, in fact, the director of the Tax Justice Network, which has been campaigning for many years. He himself used to work for Deloitte, but I spoke to him earlier this week and asked him about various, I mean, I'll put a longer version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But he's saying effectively that the Pandora, in fact, like Martin and I were saying just before we sat down and came on air, that the Pandora Papers are kind of more of the same, really. We're just hearing the same kind of stuff. And nothing really is being done about it. Martin, I mean, we had the Panama Papers. This is the Pandora Papers. The same consortium of journalists in Washington also came out recently with the China Papers, which are apparently a load of things which were leaked by Uyghurs in the United States. And it does seem that they're taking a particularly political tinge, some of these, that maybe the, you know, some of the big players are simply not on these lists.
Well, that's the way it works, isn't it? These revelations are carefully stage managed, a bit like the MP's expenses scandal, which, as you know, basically people who were protected, we still don't know what Tony Blair's expenses were because he was protected. People who are targeted are the people that the intelligence services in the West want to keep in line.
That was interesting, the MP's expenses, wasn't it? It turned out it was some former Special Forces guy that had gone in and pinched a hard drive.
That's right.
And then that hard drive was copied and certain bits were deleted from the hard drive, like, as you say, Tony Blair. Some of the more right-wing elements in the Conservative Party were also deleted. And then it was handed to the Daily Telegraph. But that is giving you a very partial view of the scandal.
Well, that's right, because what actually happened was Labour politicians were just being phoned up cold and said, we've got your expenses here, what about whatever it is? Whereas Tory politicians were being phoned and said, we're going to phone you tomorrow to ask about these expenses, think about what you're going to say. And some people weren't phoned at all. And what should have been done with something like that is surely just publish the lot and let everybody look at it.
Or but maybe, of course, the Barclay maybe not, brothers, maybe not steal it in the first place.
Well,
you know, this is a theft.
That was also how this came into the public domain was through a theft. And the Barclay brothers could have been prosecuted for, but they shouldn't have been prosecuted. The person who stole it should have been prosecuted, and he was an ex-SAS bankrupt. Okay, so that's one of the things.
Well,
we're
I don't think the Barclay brothers, the Telegraph owners, should have been prosecuted. That's almost like saying Julian Assange should be. Journalists should not be prosecuted.
No, but on the other hand, as you know, David Cameron flew out there to talk to them after all this blew up to decide what they were going to do and who was going to be targeted.
Out to SARC.
Yeah, out to SARC when we went to look into it. And the point about these revelations of tax evasion and so on is that if you're on, you know, Delaware in the United States, for example, is a major tax haven. That is Joe Biden's home constituency. And if you attack people in Cayman Islands, people get their money out of the Cayman Islands and they put it somewhere else.
Well, one of the positive things John had to say was that he thinks that Biden is actually making some serious moves now to close down tax havens in the United States and anywhere that they are possible, and also to put pressure on the Brits, political pressure on the Brits, to close some of their tax havens. Anyway, let's have a listen now to a clip, and there's a longer interview which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to John Christensen, outgoing director of the Tax Justice Network, now talking about the Panama Papers.
For obvious reasons, because of all the secrecy surrounding these offshore accounts and the offshore trusts and the offshore companies, we really don't have accurate figures for the amount of wealth that's held offshore and untaxed. There's a researcher in the United States, in New York, called Jim Henry, and I think his work in this is possibly the most accurate. And he, quite a few years ago, he put the figure of wealth held offshore untaxed, as it's held by private individuals offshore, largely through trusts and offshore shell companies. He puts it at somewhere around $36 trillion, which is a hell of a lot of money. As far as the tax losses are concerned, I mean, a lot of people think it's all about losing income tax or losing corporate income tax. It isn't. I mean, in many cases, the really wealthy people, the billionaires and the multimillionaires who are using offshore, are trying to avoid capital gains tax, inheritance taxes, wealth taxes across the board. Yes, they might well be avoiding some income tax and so on, but that's not their highest priority. At least certainly when I worked offshore for quite a few years, employed by a company called Deloitte, that most of the clients were not actually that concerned about income tax. They could keep their income quite low. They were much more interested in avoiding capital gains taxes and wealth taxes. So, quite clearly, that sums of taxes being lost to governments across the world run to hundreds of billions of dollars every single year. Again, I've seen some estimates. I think they're very low side, in the region of 600 billion. But I think that's low side, because it's not really we really don't have a clear figure of how much wealth is held offshore.
No, I mean, this is actually, there's a subtext to all of this, which is pretty shocking, really, because many of these billionaires, if they were to lose half of their wealth in tax, they would notice absolutely no difference whatsoever in their lifestyle at all. And in fact, even if 90% of their wealth was taken, they still wouldn't notice a difference in lifestyle. And yet those who are now paying the tax that they should be paying, in other words, the poor, are very often left in the situation where, for example, They have to go to food banks. They can't afford to feed their children.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the issue. And what we've seen, this is particularly since the era of Thatcherism and Reaganism, is that wealth has become extraordinarily concentrated in the hands of a tiny, tiny elite. I mean, at the time of the great financial crisis, the activists were talking about the 1%, but no, actually, wealth is very much more concentrated in the hands of the kind of 0.0001%, a handful of billionaires who control absolutely astonishing sums of wealth. In most cases, that wealth is not owned by them being extraordinary capitalists or extraordinary entrepreneurs. They gain that wealth through having monopolies, through having concentrations of economic power, which means they can extract wealth from the rest of the world. And here is another problem which people might now need to start getting their heads around, which is that alongside the tax havens and the tax evasion and capital being so hard to tax these days, governments have allowed wealth and corporate power to become extraordinarily concentrated. And today everyone's talking about Facebook and the latest revelations about Facebook. But there you have a billionaire who's proud of the corporate power that Facebook has. Of course, it's a monopoly. Of course, they're extracting extraordinary sums of wealth. And of course, they're showing absolutely no corporate social responsibility whatsoever. But they seem to be beyond the power of governments to control them. That's the problem we face in the modern world, Tony. You know, this extraordinary concentration of corporate power is allowing companies like Facebook to extract wealth from the entire world.
Yeah, but the thing is, you're saying that governments have allowed this. Governments have got really no choice, because these people are just, it's almost like whack-a-mole. As they go for the money just disappears and pops up somewhere else in the world.
Well, I don't agree that governments have no choice. Actually, governments have had a choice for many, many years. For example, the British government has a competition policy. It has a competition authority, the Competition and Market Authority. And that authority really has done very little. In fact, you know, the City of London celebrates its involvement in mergers and acquisitions here in the UK and across the rest of the world. And everyone seems to think that this is a really good thing. Look at all this money that's being invested in mergers and acquisitions. But actually what's happening is these mergers and acquisitions are leading to very concentrated market power, and that's leading to wealth extraction. So actually governments do have the power to take action. They just choose to not do that.
We've seen in the, for example, recently with the demise of Morrisons being bought up by these hedge funds, another supermarket which is owned by hedge funds. It does seem as if we're getting into a situation where there's a handful of big investment funds, John, that are pretty much owning everything. So there isn't any real, you know, obviously, you know, for say Pepsi and Coke, both owned by Vanguard. There's these massive companies like BlackRock too that seem to own everything now.
Well, that's quite right. And again, you know, it seems to be unquestioned that either hedge funds or private equity funds are buying up absolutely everything. And no one's actually asking, well, is this a good thing? And the answer is absolutely not. It's not a very good thing at all. In fact, quite the opposite, because this financialization of the entire economy is simply accelerating the process of creating wealth-extracting monopolies.
Can you just explain what you mean by that term, financialization?
Yes, what I mean is that typically the private equity model is to buy a perfectly good company, and Morrisons is a perfectly good company. And of course, they're now beginning. Private equity is now beginning to look at Sainsbury's and possibly even Tesco's. What they'll typically do is load the company with loads of debt. Very often that debt is sitting offshore. The company is then forced to pay huge amounts of interest to service this huge debt. Alongside that, they will typically cut staff costs. They'll cut back on investment in you know, real things, you know, in improving quality of service to customers. Cuts across the board in order to immediately boost profitability, which will boost the returns to the private equity people, but at the cost of lower wages, worse working conditions for employees, and probably higher prices in the long run for our consumers.
Well, it's one of the greatest analysts in the world on tax avoidance, tax havens, etc. John Christensen there speaking to me earlier this week. The full version of that interview will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. Martin, I suppose what people need to do is just look over pop into Morrisons once every month or every couple of months over the next year or so, and watch it just slowly but surely be destroyed. So that is to say that the prices start going up, the staff start looking more gloomy because they're not getting paid properly, and they brought bullying managers in. This is effectively what's happened in almost every industry. This is just one example where these they are, some people call them vulture funds, don't they? They come in and they just take out competition. The competition is just removed. Say, so for example, like British Home Stores was on the high street. No more competition from Marks and Spencers. Everyone rubs their hands and up go the prices.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just at that level. It's also at higher levels as well. You know, the bailout of the banks in 2008 is completely in defiance of free market logic. And, of course, at the same time, you'd have thought that at that point people say, hang on a minute, if the state or the various states in the world are on the hook for all of this losses that are made by the private equity system, then they've got to control that system. But of course, what happened was by bailing them out, they then become rejuvenated and then they come back for more. It's a bit like Alfred the Great or rather Edmund the Unready and the Danegeld. Yeah. If you pay them off, that doesn't solve the problem because they come back for more. And of course, ultimately, what this is doing is undermining the productive economy. So in the United States, the productive economy has been gradually undermined over years. And of course, that is coming to a head.
By a series of rackets, really.
By a series of rackets.
It's like Al Capone writ large.
That's right. And of course, the problem for the ruling class in the United States is that doesn't happen in the same kind of way in China, because the banking system is controlled by the government. And they basically make sure, as the Japanese Ministry of International Trade and Industry used to do before 1989, that these rackets are not allowed to function in the same kind of way, and therefore they're more productive. They've got more people at work, more skilled, their price-to-quality ratio is better, and they're out-competing
US
capitalism.
Their quality of life is better too.
Well, you could argue that, certainly. Yeah. Your probably quality of life is better for up-and-coming middle-class people in China than it is in the ghettos in the United States, no doubt about it.
So John Christensen there is saying that governments could do something about this, but they continually don't. This does imply, doesn't it, that these billionaires are really... They're like the politicians are their glove puppets, really.
Yeah, well, the British-Polish economist Kalecki prophesied this in the 1950s. Because at that stage, the financial side of the economy was very much under control, not so much in the Soviet Union or China because they were in a different system altogether, but in the rest of the world, there was an understanding that the finances are a useful servant, but a terrible master, and therefore stock markets were very much less powerful than they are today. It took until late 50s for the stock market to get back to where it cracked, the level it had crashed at in 1929. And the idea was that we're going to keep these people under control, we're going to have lots of government investment, nationalised industries, strong trade unions, rising wages every year on the back of rising productivity, and that was actually the most successful model of capitalism there's ever been. But it's been, Kalecki said, it won't be because it's successful that it will be ended, it will be because the traditional ruling class will get fed up with it, and they'll say, we want to go back to the 19th century, where we used to do everything that we wanted, and nobody told us. And once the Soviet Union collapsed, that was the moment that they decided, right, we've had enough of being nice to the workers, it's time to go back to the old way of doing things. And of course, the old way of doing things is exactly what led to the crash of 1929 and then on to the World War II.
Okay, well, let's also have a listen now to Boris's answer to all of this, as well as, I mean, he talks here a bit about some of the foreign policy stuff, Martin. Be interesting to see your take. Here is... 4 or 5 minutes of Boris's big speech this week at the Tory conference, his keynote speech. The idea really is to entertain and get everyone clapping and get everyone happy, but the question is, how grounded is this in reality?
We need to remember how and why we've been able to back people through this pandemic at all. It was because we Conservatives fixed the economy, we repaired the damage that Labour left behind. Every Labour government has left office with unemployment higher than when it came in, every single one, ever since the party was invented. And today we are going to fix this economy and build back better than ever before. And just as we used our new freedoms to accelerate the vaccine rollout, we're going to use Brexit freedoms to do things differently. We're doing the borders bill, we've seen off the European Super League and protected grassroots football. We're doing at least... We're doing at least 8 free ports, super fertilised loam, in which business will be able to plant new jobs across the UK. And now we're going to go further, not only jettisoning EU rules we don't need anymore, but using new freedoms to improve the way we regulate in the great growth areas of the 21st century as we fulfil our ambition of becoming a science superpower. Gene editing, data management, AI, cyber, quantum, and we're going to be ever more global in our outlook. We've done already 68 free trade deals, including that great free trade deal with our friends in the EU, which they all said was impossible. And after decades of bewildering refusal, we have persuaded the Americans to import prime British beef, a market already worth £66 million. Build back burger, I say. And you ask yourself, how have the Americans been able to survive without British beef for so long? If you want a supreme example of global Britain in action, of something daring and brilliant that would simply not have happened if we'd remained in the EU, I give you AUKUS. AUKUS. An idea so transparently right that Labour conference voted overwhelmingly against it. And I know there has been a certain raucous caucus from the anti-AUKUS caucus, but AUKUS is simply a recognition of the reality that the world is tilting on its axis, on its economic axis, and our trade and relations in the Indo-Pacific region are becoming more vital than ever before. And that's why we sent our amazing carrier strike group to the Far East, performing manoeuvres with 40 friendly countries, HMS Queen Elizabeth, as long as the entire Palace of Westminster. And rather more compelling as an argument than many of the speeches made in the House of Commons. It has dozens of F-35s on board, 66,000 sausages. And not because we want to threaten anyone or be adversarial to anyone, either with the F-35s or indeed the sausages, but because we want to, stick up for the rule of law that is so vital for freedom of navigation and free trade. And that's what brings AUKUS together, Australia, UK, US, shared values, a shared belief in democracy and human rights, a shared belief in the equal dignity and worth of every human being. Very few countries could have pulled off the Kabul airlift, an astonishing feat by our brave armed forces. Even fewer... Even fewer have the same moral priorities. No other government brokered a deal such as this government did with AstraZeneca, so that the Oxford vaccine has been distributed at cost around the world. More than a billion low-cost vaccines invented in Britain, saving millions of lives. We're led by our values, by the things we stand for. And we should never forget that people around the world admire this country for its history and traditions, and they love the groovy new architecture and the fashion and the music and all the rest of it. The chance of meeting the Michael in the disco, but they like it for the way it emerges organically, the way all that emerges organically from a vast inherited conglomerate of culture and tradition. And we conservatives understand the need for both and how each nourishes the other. And we attack and deny our history at our peril. And when they began to attack Churchill as a racist, I was minded to ignore them because it's only 20 years ago since BBC audiences overwhelmingly voted him the greatest Briton of all time. Because he...
Okay, we'll leave it there. So he's going on about Churchill being a racist or not a racist, a hero. Martin, what do you make of what Boris is saying there? He's talking particularly about the carrier strike group chugging around the world with the HMS Queen Elizabeth enforcing the rule of law and navigation of the seas.
Well, I would imagine that a lot of people voted for Brexit because they wanted bread and butter issues resolved in this country. And they felt that there was far too much attention being paid to foreign affairs in France and further afield. So I think it's very interesting that it suddenly comes out that in actual fact the purpose of Brexit is so that we can go to war with China on the other side of the world. Who would have thought it? And of course when he's talking about the global change is that China is becoming the major economic power in the world. So what do we do?
Yeah,
we team up with Australia to annoy the Chinese. And it's not very good for Australia and it's certainly no use to us. And of course this is really what's going on underlying all of this. And all this stuff about sausages, 60,000 sausages on the ship. This is willy waving, isn't it? This is willy waving, sticking up for what? Sticking up our willies at the Chinese. Now, in actual fact, what's going to happen? The Australians are going to find that the Chinese won't buy their stuff. And they've got the most overvalued property market in the world, as Steve Keen will tell you. And the Chinese are just going to pop that property market. So that all the right-wing voters in Australia who think it's a jolly good idea to go to war with China will find they lose their equity. Meanwhile, of course, sensible New Zealand is not getting involved. No nuclear-armed warships are allowed in New Zealand ever. From any country, from the 1980s onwards.
Well,
and they're not going to change that policy.
What about Winston Churchill? I mean, certainly the investigations that I've done suggest that he was doing a party to deals done at the end of the Second World War because he was particularly anti-Soviet, even though he was dealing with Stalin through the war. After the Second World War, Churchill was talking about wanting to nuke Moscow, this sort of thing. He's put across as this hero. Apparently, the BBC survey said that that the public think that he's a great guy. But actually, there's a famous statement by him, which I trot out from time to time. which is, history will be kind to me, I know, because I will write it. And actually, what's happening is, slowly, history is unravelling, and Churchill is turning out not to be quite the little angel. In fact, in my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, Churchill definitely features there, along with his private secretary, Desmond Morton, as someone who actually would much rather do deals in 1944 and 1945 for Nazi technology, for Nazi money, for Nazi enriched uranium, than he would do deals with the communists.
Well, indeed. And I mean, the fact about somebody like Churchill is a complex figure. And the idea that he was 100% a good guy is simply wrong. He opposed, for example, the independence of India. He supported the first gassing of the Kurds in Iraq. He was responsible for the Gallipoli landings, where Australian New Zealand Army Corps were decimated, because, of course, it's perfectly logical that Australia and New Zealand should be invading Turkey. It's obviously in their interest.
Don't forget the Canadians at Dieppe in the Second World War.
Oh, the Canadians at Dieppe and so on. Now, the idea that we've all got to worship at the feet of Churchill, I'd also point out that Churchill lost the election at the end of World War II, and probably the greatest Prime Minister we've had was, in fact,
Clement Attlee,
who built the National Health Service, nationalised the coal mines, the railways and all the rest of it, and built modern Britain, which Churchill would never have done if it had been left to him.
Well, it was a good decision, wasn't it, by the British people? I think Ken Loach did a film about that.
That's right. It's called Spirit of 45.
Let's have a listen now to... I mean, you never listened to Carrie. She was Carrie Simmons. She's now Carrie Johnson. And her contribution, because she seems to be the Conservatives' spokesperson for LGBT rights. This doesn't come across to me as a sort of speech that could be made to conference without a little bit of almost like Starmer-esque heckling from last week. But she made the speech to a smaller group in a room on their own. But anyway, this is what Carrie Johnson had to say about LGBT rights and how Boris is going to be extending them.
Around the world, being LGBT plus is still a crime in 71 countries. In 11 countries, it is punishable by death, just because of who you love. None of this is acceptable, obviously, and it is up to all of us to stand up and say so as loudly as we can. And that is why it is so important that the UK will be hosting its first ever global conference of LGBT plus rights next year. So whether it's about ending prejudice at home or abroad, LGBT plus Conservatives champion all these issues. So please keep doing what you're doing. But also, please keep doing something else as well. Because groups like this don't just exist to campaign. They also provide a support network for their members. Every LGBT plus person must go on their own journey of self-acceptance. And that, I can imagine, is not always easy. There will be some people here tonight who are out to their friends, but maybe not to their family. Or to their family, but not their work colleagues. There might be some people here who are not out to anyone, or questioning who they are. Wherever you are in your journey, I can assure you, you are among friends here. So thank you, LGBT Conservatives, for everything you do. I know how hard you and your team work, Eleanor, and I hope you all have a brilliant evening and a wonderful conference, and I hope to see some of you on the dance floor.
So that's Carrie Johnson. Now, do you think the Conservatives are serious about backing this? It doesn't sound to me like the typical Tory... in fact, it isn't Conservative, is it? It's not keeping the things the way they are. It's changing it all around to have Conservative LGBT plus rights, particularly the Prime Minister's wife championing them.
Well, I mean, I think this is a political manoeuvre by the Johnson couple. So... Johnson himself, in the main speech in the conference hall, is giving lots of red meat to the right wing about global Britain, sticking it to the Chinese, you know, waving our willy, etc. And then, of course, they've got to have a softer side, and that would be Carrie being nice about gay people. And as she pointed out, there are lots of countries in the world where being gay is illegal. It's legal in China, it's legal in Russia, but our glorious allies in Saudi Arabia will put you to death if you are gay. I think it's about time we cancelled all our arms contracts with them, don't you, Tony? But that's not really what they're on about, is it?
Not at all. And yeah, I think we're going to, I mean, the Sweeney business, I think we'll just kick it back till to part two, because it doesn't seem appropriate to talk about the Sweeney in the same breath as we're talking about real police corruption. And we're going to just take a glance over the Bristol Channel to Cardiff and Newport now, because one of the most, I think anyway, horrific decisions was made last week, which is to bring in these COVID data passports. They're called COVID passports, but a lot of the people over in Cardiff are calling them data passports because they have a fantastic amount of your medical data on them, apparently. And it only managed to squeeze through by one vote. And that was because one of the members of the Senedd, the MSs, couldn't actually get connected up, so they couldn't take his vote. So there was some problem with his internet. Martin's funny because Dave, our sound engineer, and me and you have already having our problems with the internet this week. It could be nothing, but it also, you know, this is one of the problems. It's quite feasible that a firm could be employed in order to nobble somebody's internet so they can't vote in an important vote like this, couldn't it?
Well, in theory, yes, but, you know, they've got to have evidence for everything, haven't you?
Well, surely, I mean, if he's clear about which way he's going to vote, it doesn't matter if he's not actually online at the time. Can't he just phone in or something?
Well, I don't know what the rules are about things like that.
Why on earth is the Welsh Parliament not actually meeting face-to-face? What's going on?
I don't know, Tony.
Anyway, let's have a listen to the last honest politician in Wales, as I love to call him. He's not a member of the Senedd anymore. He was a Cardiff MS, and in the May elections, he was removed because he didn't get hardly any media publicity, because he's not part of one of the big parties, Labour or Plaid Cymru. He's an ex-member of both of those parties, and for trying to tell the truth within those parties, Neil McEvoy was sacked first from Labour and then from Plaid Cymru too. But let's have a listen now to what he's got to say about this rigged vote this week about COVID data passports.
We now have data passports, they're called COVID passports, whereby a whole load of data about you will have to be presented if you are to go into large-scale events. And the vote took place yesterday. If you see on the caption, I said that it was a rigged vote, because it was. There was a politician, an opposition politician, for whatever reason, was not able to get online into the vote, and he was denied the opportunity to vote. And the government passed the policy by just one vote. So if that individual had been allowed to vote against the Welsh government, against the Labour government in Wales, then we would not have COVID passports being introduced. I know the Senedd well. I was there for 5 years. 5 years of abuse, basically. 5 years of looking and experiencing abuses of process. It's not a parliament. It's a private club. It's run by individuals who do favours for the governing party. And what took place yesterday was highly undemocratic. I've been speaking to people today. There's a boxing event coming up, and if people want to go to that in November, then they're going to have either tests or a passport. Now, what I find heavily ironic is that if you are double jabbed, you can still pass on the virus and you can still catch the virus. So if the whole focus was about safety, then everybody would have to be tested, for example. But if you look at what they do with PCR tests, it really depends on the amount of cycles that the tests have. And some of you out there may not know what the cycles are. But what it actually means is when you go above a certain point of a cycle, the way that it is tested, then it renders the test almost meaningless in some circumstances. If you do up to 45 cycles, for example, there'll be lots and lots of false positives, lots and lots of false negatives. That's a fact. So really, really concerned. Just looking through some of the comments, Katie said about the PCR test being flawed. The inventor of the PCR test said it wasn't a diagnosis. So if you want to be diagnosed, or if you have to be diagnosed with COVID, you should have another medical examination as well as a PCR test. I want to deal with things like Cardiff City, because, I mean, people will not now be able to go to games. And I was speaking to somebody earlier who is actually double jabbed. And that individual does not want to carry a passport, does not want to have to sign in with his medical data. So I'm wondering whether or not there'll be a refund on the season ticket, for example. I think this legislation could possibly be challenged through court. I'm not convinced that it's compatible with the European Convention on Human Rights. The reason we have the Convention on Human Rights is because of the Second World War. And our forefathers and foremothers fought for our freedoms, which are now being taken away. And the whole point of the Convention on Human Rights was to make sure that what went on in the Second World War, such as medical experimentation, where people didn't have a choice about what was put into them, the whole drive of the human rights agenda was to stop that ever happening again. And what we have now, and I see comments on social media from supposed people who used to call themselves progressives, they're talking about compulsory vaccination, compulsory jabbing at people. And I'm really concerned as well with a lack of parental rights. Let me be totally clear. I believe in choice. I believe in informed choice, as guaranteed by Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. That's what I believe in. And whether or not you want to have the jab or not, it should be up to you making an informed choice. I'm really unsure how a 12-year-old can make an informed choice against what his or her parents want, for example. And I used to be a teacher. I was a teacher by profession originally. And you're not allowed to give paracetamol to children. I mean, and yet they're going to administer now jabs to children. And I don't see the value in giving our children those jabs. I'm talking now not in terms of a politician, but really as a parent, because I'm looking at my children, and how are they going to benefit from a jab with a virus that they will recover from? It doesn't, the symptoms are not serious for young people. And even the Pfizer scientists now say that natural immunity is better. So I'm really not sure what benefits our children are going to get from having this jab. When you're talking about vulnerable people, I know there are very, very many different views on the jab, but when you're talking about vulnerable people, maybe in their 80s and so on, it's a different kettle of fish to healthy teenagers having a jab, the long-term effects of which we simply do not know. And that's the key point. So what I'm talking about really is the issue of freedom and a lack of freedom. We see it with children's services. We see it in some cases with adult services. We see it now with COVID. Even council elections, the Labour Party legislated. They passed a law, and supported by Plaid Cymru, to make sure only certain categories of people could stand for election for council. Quite staggering. They took away the right to local referenda. We used to have local referenda before on a number of issues. They took away that. That right as well. And I mean, these are really worrying times. I'm in court as well, personally, on the 21st of October. And I am charged with leaving my house in February. Well, you tell me any other politician in Wales who didn't leave their house. Few and far between. Saw them on television, saw them on social media, selfies, pictures. And yet, I'm the only politician in Wales being prosecuted. And the reason is I will not pay the fine. I did nothing wrong, and I'm not paying the fine. So I'm in court on the 21st of October. I believe in the rule of law. So therefore, I'm looking forward to being able to defend myself, using the law, actually, against what is developing into a kind of tyranny, really. When I was in the Senate, at the end of the term, I felt more like a dissident, to be honest, rather than an opposition politician, because if you worked in my office, if you had contact with my office, it was like the Alamo. It was like the Alamo. I mean, Labour, Plaid Cymru just wanted us out. And in the short term, they had their way. But there's unfinished business there. We are Propel. We are a party. New people are joining. We stand for election in council areas next year. And it's really, really important that people get involved in politics. One in two people didn't vote for the council, for the Welsh election in May when Drakeford got back in. One in two. Some areas with council elections, three and four don't vote. And we get these people re-elected time after time after time. Well, everyone has to take responsibility for that, for letting that happen. We cannot let it happen in future.
So that's the former member of the Synod, Neil McAvoy, the Welsh Parliament. Martin is saying, particularly, he's saying there's a complete disillusion, really, with politics in Wales. Basically, it's not a parliament. It's a club where everything gets fixed up behind the scenes. Decisions are made before votes are taken, and people just simply follow a party line. In fact, they're recruited into Plaid Cymru and Labour to stand for election simply because they're pliable and they will do what they're told by the whips. And in a way, of course, that is reflected in his final comments there, which is this whole business of maybe only 25% and maximum up to 50% voter turnouts in elections.
Well, that's not just true in Wales. That's true across the board. And, of course, that's an issue that needs to be addressed by all politicians.
Wasn't true on the Brexit vote, was it?
Well, it was, in fact, because the large number of people didn't participate.
It wasn't
50% that didn't participate, but it was about 40% didn't participate.
If you have a look at the statistics, I know you're very, you know, you don't like anything to do with Brexit, Martin.
No, I do. Let's discuss Brexit, by all means.
But if you look at the...
But no crying for mummies, eh?
Well, no. And, well, we can go there, absolutely right. But you do have to actually let me speak. So what I'm trying to say here is that we had a slowly declining participation in general elections since the Kinnock era, through the Blair era, going even lower and lower. And then once it got to the Brexit vote, suddenly things start to pick up. And the 2019 election, which was all about Brexit, because the Conservatives were pro-Brexit even 3 years after the vote, and the Labour Party was still flim-flamming. And so people just wanted to get it over with, and they didn't want to have this continual problem. So that's the reason why many more people voted for that. It was up to the same levels of voter participation in the Brexit vote as the 1960s and 1970s, when general elections were very tightly fought, and get people engaged because they felt that there was a difference in who they're going to vote for.
Well, you're right about that, and 57% of the people who voted in our ridiculous system voted for a second referendum, but they didn't get that, did they? 43% wanted Brexit done, which it isn't done, because if the Northern Ireland Protocol goes down the drain, the whole deal fails. So 43% voted to get Brexit done, and 57% voted to have a second referendum. And of course, in Northern Ireland, people voted, and in Scotland, people voted to stay in the EU. And, of course, the question is, who gets the vote?
Well, I don't know.
Where does sovereignty end?
This idea that, what is it, you say 60% of people wanted a second referendum.
57%.
Nobody wanted a second referendum. Where do you get that figure from?
No, all the parties, Plaid Cymru, Labour, the Greens, Sinn Féin, Social Democratic and Labour Party, Scottish National Party, Alliance Party in Northern Ireland, all of them said we'll have a second referendum on any deal. And the 57% of people across the UK voted for those parties. But because we've got a first-past-the-post system designed in the 18th century, the 43% of the vote who wanted Brexit done got an 80-seat majority, and then we got Brexit done, except it isn't done.
So responsibility is on Jeremy Corbyn for that, isn't it?
No.
Because he could have made the difference.
Well, what Corbyn's mistake, in my view, if you're asking me, is he shouldn't have voted to invoke Article 50 of the where you start the clock running to leave. You didn't have to do that. The European Union was saying you don't have to do that. And we all voted to get it done, which meant, of course, that we then got 2 years with the clock ticking. That was all totally unnecessary.
You'd still love to be in the EU, wouldn't
you? So would the majority of people in Northern Ireland.
That's blocking
which is not actually part of the UK.
That's blocking the...
Although it is, because some people think it should be.
That's blocking the Russian gas, for example.
No.
It's a big corporate club.
No. The EU isn't blocking the Russian gas. The Germans want to have Nord Stream 2. The British and the Americans are telling them they can't. And it's a matter of sovereignty, German sovereignty. Just as in Northern Ireland, where a majority voted to stay in the EU, that's a matter of Irish sovereignty. It's not just English sovereignty that matters, okay? And the English have got rather arrogant over the years. They think they can tell the Chinese what to do, therefore there's no problem telling the Irish what to do.
It's the British actually that voted for Brexit, not the English.
The British
and
people,
the Welsh. And yes, by the way, we're talking about Wales.
Yes, but in the election in 2019, which you brought up, which had a high turnout because people were passionate on both sides, 57% of people voted for a second referendum.
Yeah, something worth voting for, because it was actually about national sovereignty.
That's right. 57% voted for a second referendum, Tony.
But
they didn't get what they wanted, because the system's rigged.
Rather than having our, for example, our industry and our finance directed from Brussels.
Or directed from the United States of America.
Well, it's
via the City of London.
To a certain extent, it is, yeah.
Well, yes, well, and that's what the real problem is, isn't it?
At least there's a little bit of independence.
The EU aren't sending their warships to a little bit of independence. There's no independence for Ireland, is there? They voted to stay in the EU, the six counties and the Republic. Mm. This has caused huge problems for them.
Well,
what about their
sovereignty? You know, you're still a Romaniac, obviously.
Anyway, no, I'm an Irish Republican Labour activist, as you constantly call me.
You're somebody who just wants to overturn...
The single market isn't going anywhere, Tony.
Somebody that wants to overturn the 2016 vote.
They're if we had a referendum and we won it, then we would be the majority. It's 50% plus one, isn't it?
They're called Romaniacs. Anyway, we were actually talking about Wales.
No, that's a political statement. I'm in favour of the EU. I would call you a Brexit nutcase, but that's silly, isn't it? I'm not a Romaniac or a Ramona. I'm in favour of the single market and the EU, as the majority of people in Northern Ireland were. And as you constantly say, I'm an Irish Republican Labour activist. What position do you expect me to take?
Well, I mean, you can just go along with the election like most people do.
No, you don't have to.
You know, you don't have
referendum,
to
the referendum was advisory. We have a parliamentary system in this country and a first-past-the-post. If they had a...
Do you think it would have been, everyone wanted to keep this going for years and years then? Or
it is going to go on for years and years because the Northern Ireland Protocol, which has been signed into law by the British government, they're trying to get out of it.
Because of people
and if
like
they
you.
Get out of it, no. No, not because of people like me, Tony, because people like the Loyalists who don't like it, even though they're a minority in Northern Ireland.
That was Boris that did that.
Yes, anyway, he did, indeed. And now he's trying to overturn it. And if it is overturned,
here to talk
if
about
Frost overturns
going.
It, the whole deal is off. And we're going to be talking about the next deal about Brexit till it's sorted. And that means it's going to go on and on and on. You pro-Brexit people don't want to talk about Brexit anymore. You think it's over. It's not over because the Northern Ireland Protocol is still in
well,
play.
We shall see. And obviously
the
Romaniacs are around the world, including people like Shell and BP, are doing everything they can to disrupt
Arthur Scargill is a pro-Brexit person, but he wants a united Ireland, so there's no problem with the Northern Ireland Protocol. You're a left-wing pro-Brexit person. Do you want a united Ireland?
I would like to see a vote, a referendum, yeah.
Right, well, maybe there should
be. Irish want to do.
Well, exactly.
That's
exactly.
None of my business, really.
No, it isn't. And therefore, they've got a right to say, we're not being told what to do by the English.
It's quite likely.
It's like national sovereignty, like in Slovenia, breaking out of Yugoslavia.
It's quite, Martin.
Or Bosnia.
It's so difficult when you just keep shouting all the time. The idea that the Irish would have a referendum on their own fate, of course, is perfectly normal and natural. We were just hearing there that the Welsh government have stopped referenda in Wales. And the rising levels of corruption in Cardiff are very disturbing, from what we heard from Neil McAvoy there. And he was his party is called Propel, and he's hoping to get back into politics in the Senedd, and obviously I would imagine standing as a candidate for Westminster in future elections too. But somebody else who's had trouble in Cardiff, I mean, we had a really shocking interview last week with the policeman Tony Roach, the ex-policeman who has been bullied out of his job basically by senior police in Cardiff, in South Wales Police, who have been taking evidence from violent criminals and then using that to sack him. He was an honest policeman working in nightclubs in Cardiff, and because he was stopping the work of criminal drug dealers, the senior police in Cardiff actually sacked him. And they completely tore up their own procedures by having the same police who were spending £1 million or so following him around and gathering evidence sitting on a disciplinary panel, which is completely goes against all of the rules. And yet there are various people who should be overseeing this process, should be sacking these senior cops in South Wales for malfeasance and misconduct in public office, and also perverting the course of justice by operating with known criminals. But somebody we've been talking to for quite a long time about the corruption in South Wales Police is a guy called Maurice Kirk, and he was originally prosecuted for having a machine gun. I mean, it's a bizarre case. He had an aircraft which had a decommissioned machine gun. It was a replica machine gun on the plane, a biplane from the First World War. And so the police decided to prosecute him for having this machine gun as if he was some sort of terrorist. But anyway, this was all because the original problem for Morris had been it was a tenant of his who was, I think it was the boyfriend of his tenant, who was the son of a police superintendent in South Wales. And that guy happened to be a drug dealer. And so he decided to, first of all, report this drug dealer to the police, and secondly, to evict them from his property. He didn't want drugs being dealt on his property. And then he found the South Wales police, since that time, back in the 1990s, have pursued a vendetta against him, stopping his car two or three times a week, making him produce his licence, and really totally abusing their power. So let's have a listen now as a sort of reflection on last week's police constable who was sacked unlawfully from South Wales Police, and this is Maurice Kirk now, driven out of Wales effectively by criminal police.
I mean, I was before Lord Chief Justice Birkett, no less, the boss of our law courts, and I won a case there. Janet, my first wife, was trying to take notes in Newport Court, a Crown Court. I was accused, I'd been arrested for entering a prison without permission. By the time it got to court, they switched it to assault on a prison officer inside the prison. They'd stolen my passport so that I couldn't come over here to get my paperwork on the machine gun conspiracy. They made out that I had flown my vintage aeroplane at Farnborough at the personal invitation of Brian Trubshaw, and that it had a working prohibited weapon on the front. It was a make-believe mock-up machine gun, a Lewis machine gun, Battle of the Somme. And many years after it was sold, they arrested me and jailed me for 8 months. And when they realized they were going to lose that case, because I refused to use a lawyer, very dangerous in Wales to employ a lawyer, because you give them your defense. And if they are leaned on, they have to give that information to the South Wales police. So I learnt that one a bit late down the line. But on the machine gun case, I went to court and there was 8 ladies on the jury, most of them from the valleys. And it was like Wimbledon. It was like center court. Their knuckles, their white knuckles over the balustrade, looking left, looking right. I was cross-examining each bent policeman, and oh, the lies in that course. I paid thousands of pounds for that transcript. And at this recent one, last week, 2 weeks ago, a civil claim where I'm suing them for the fabrication of the machine gun conspiracy, they dragged me into a pub afterwards, or 8 of them. And of course, it's sacrosanct. You must not talk to anybody of a jury. It is absolutely, it's as serious as we must maintain our lay magistrates, and as serious as we must maintain an independent jury. And of course, this bent judge 3 weeks ago would not let me have a jury for the civil claim. And I said, well, it's so simple. The criminal jury found me not guilty very quickly. And in the pub afterwards, they were telling us all that, of course, there was a policeman on the jury. He was the only one who refused to discuss the case, because that's the level of deceit in South Wales. That's why there has to be a proper government investigation going back 20 years. I mean, I know 20 years of clients who cried on my shoulder about the way I'm fighting them each week. I was in court every week back in the 90s, winning my trivial, stupid motoring things. But it's now serious. I mean, they have destroyed the lives of a lot of Welsh families by lying, because they are not answerable to anybody. There is no control over the South Wales Police?
Well, there's certainly supposed to be control, not only from the Home Office, but also from the Professional Standards Department of South Wales Police, Martin, and the now we've got these police commissioners too, but still they're getting away with it.
Well, it's hard to comment because I don't know enough about the circumstances surrounding this. I hear that the various clips that you've had this week and previous weeks about malfeasance in the South Wales Police. And I've no reason to doubt that the people speaking are speaking honestly. But to ask me what I think about it, I just don't know enough to have a strong opinion.
Well, it's quite feasible, though, isn't it, that the police, all they've got to do is control a handful of individuals and they can start to do what they want. What we said last week, and I think that's one of the things I said, was that you've got a lot of political and financial power concentrated in Cardiff. And so there's going to be forces out there, people and individuals that want to make sure that if they do something that they shouldn't do, that they're not going to be brought to book for it. Simple as that.
Well, that's a general, you can say that that's generally true everywhere, isn't it? I mean, obviously the powerful like to be above the law.
There is
to bend the law in their interest.
There's quite
a
big motivation for corruption in a capital city like that.
Well, yes, but I mean, it doesn't just have to be in a capital city. Anywhere where there is money and power, then you're going to find people trying to abuse it.
I mean, we've found, for example, here in Bristol, we've got on Castle Park, actually, they seem to have moved now. I was going past there the other day. The offices seem to have completely vacated, as do the offices of Lloyds Bank in the city centre on the harbour side there, that those offices are now up for sale as well. So Lloyds seems to have done a runner from Bristol. Now we've got this new police and crime commissioner that is also the national head of fraud. They seem to have disappeared out of the city. So it may just simply be, you know, that, you know, once the police are corrupted in an area, the bankers or the politicians carry on with their corruption for a while, but then as soon as the police and the Police and Crime Commissioner change, there's a possibility that they may have to you know, move into another area where there are also some crooked cops who will protect them. I mean, this is the crazy sort of situation we're in now. Anyway, look, this does sound almost like a drama, doesn't it? I think time to talk about the Sweeney, because I had a chat last week with a chap called David Wicks. David worked for ATV. He was originally in the army. He came out of the army in Nigeria when was part of the process of overseeing independence for Nigeria. And when he came back to the UK, he started working in television at ATV and then later at the classic Euston Films under Lloyd Shirley. I thought it would be interesting to ask him really about the experience of directing programmes like The Sweeney back in the 1970s, and also comparing it to today, because he's been working in Hollywood today, and generally the whole business of TV and film drama, because it all seems to have gone down the tube since the golden age when he was doing his stuff for Euston Films.
I was a drama director. Your responsibility there is you start with a concept, change it and manipulate it and massage it a bit, commissioning the writers, oh dear, and getting to know them and finding their weaknesses and their strengths, and it's a big job just getting that far, editing their scripts, etc., choosing the locations, casting the actors.
So what sort of team, crew, has gone into this? How many people are going into producing, you know, say an hour-long drama then?
If it's based on the studio, it would probably be about 60. You've got vision mixers and editors and racks engineers and costume designers and makeup artists, and you see, everybody thinks that it's all done by the actor. It jolly well isn't. That's one of those great myths. The idea that the actor does anything other than pretend to be someone else is a myth, because that's all the actor does. Someone else make sure his hair or her hair looks right, makes a costume which is appropriate and makes all the other costumes, maybe the actor or actress.
This is a lot of people, isn't it? I mean, actually, it's quite a sort of fragile ecosystem you've got there. Because, I mean, I look now at some of the modern drama and I think, well, there's something missing. I think there was quite, you know, if you look back, even you talk to young people now, if you look back at the TV drama, in fact, on stage drama as well, that was being done in the 60s, 70s, even into the 80s, there's something missing now, it seems to me.
Well, I know I would say that, wouldn't I? But yes, there is. And someone said to me, only about a year ago, because I'd moved to Hollywood, you see, said, well, why did you leave Hollywood? And I said, well, I didn't. Hollywood left me. They couldn't grasp it. They didn't understand how it worked.
Well, they Hollywood people would try and tell you how to do things.
Exactly that. And it wasn't that way round. You can't have a movie director, and I directed a few of those, and you can't have a television drama director and tell him or her what to do. You know, either they're directing it or they aren't directing it. And if you want to tell them what to do, why don't you do it? And let's see the result when you've finished. Since they don't know anything about lighting or editing, they don't know anything about the method, they don't know anything about casting, what they are is they are people who go click, click, click on a computer in the corner office, and they earn an absolute fortune and win awards. No, the people who make the shows win the awards for them. One occasion was, I was the first to make a drama for Home Box Office. They'd never made anything like that before. And they bought movies, and there were a cable service, and put it out, a bit like Netflix without making its own, you see. And I went along, and I managed to convince them that I had got the rights. I had. But my goodness me, I had huge debt from the bank of the rights to Philip Marlowe, which, of course, there are only two big detectives in the world as far as the Americans are concerned. One of them is Sherlock Holmes and the other is Philip Marlowe. And I had the rights to Philip Marlowe. Good God. I mean, every top-ranked actor in Hollywood had played Philip Marlowe at some time. Everybody, Mitchum to Stewart, you know, it was, they all had. Raymond Chandler, yeah. And Chandler, he was an alcoholic, you know, and very difficult for him sometimes.
Yeah, he was a terrific writer. I remember, I mean, having read some of the Marlowe book, it was almost like you're watching the film as you're reading a book.
Right. Absolutely right. You know, Farewell, My Lovely, The Big Sleep, The High Window, The Little Sister. These are the major, 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 major American literature. But, of course, he was an Englishman. He was born of one English and one American parent, and he had dual nationality, but he was brought up here. Yeah, that's right.
So what were the Hollywood people trying to get you to do?
Ah, well, they were doing two things. They were trying to get you to do something which they knew was wrong and wouldn't work. You need more humour in this scene. And you think, just a minute, this guy really did care for his wife, and he wouldn't have any hint of humour. I'm telling you a big, obvious one, but it was more subtle than that usually. And there was a reason for them doing it, and that was to get one of their own friends in instead of you and get you fired, that kind of thing. There's an awful lot of that in Hollywood.
So what were the role, official role in the credits of people like that interfering with the direction?
Yes, executive producer is the favourite one, and producer is another one, and then production executive is another one, and then, oh dear, and then things, they, I'm making one up, but departmental guidance executive, you know, oh for goodness sake, they've got no role at all, but somehow or another, they've managed to get their job and hold on to it. They BS people everywhere, all the time. Yeah. And they're always promoting themselves. They know nothing about how a show is made. And if you were to introduce them to a gaffer, they wouldn't know what he was.
Okay, well, can we go back a little bit, recycle back to your days over here and making drama over here? Because I think that's, you know, if I'm right, that's where you had the most fun and you were actually learning a lot about how to do it and do it well.
Yes, it was marvellous here. And I carried it with me for the rest of my time, of course, in the business. The main thing was that we wanted to push the boat out. We wanted to expand. We wanted to go one step further. And what was so marvellous about being at ABC was that people lived around the studios. Can you believe that? Richmond, Twickenham, Hampton Wick, they were all around Teddington. And so you had a social circle as well. You were always meeting them in pubs and bars and restaurants. You were always inviting them to parties. They were inviting you to parties. And so, in other words, you knew all the designers. You knew all the costume designers. And, I mean, the names are burned in my memory even now.
It sounds like a genuine community, actually.
It was. And, of course, we were... It sounds like name-dropping rubbish, but we were sought after and enjoyed by and invited by all the people like, let's say, Mary Quant. Let's say the Beatles. Let's say the Rolling Stones, because they were in Richmond. You know, I mean, heavens above, we knew, everybody knew everybody. And the great thing was, you didn't have to refer. You had to say, oh, yeah, I don't know, you know. Brian is such a pain for those guys. You mean Brian Epstein? Yes, the man who managed the Beatles, yes. But you didn't have to say the word Epstein because everybody knew who you meant. Mm. Oh, God, yes. Have you met him? Yeah, yeah, only 5 minutes, you know. That kind of conversation. So we were a community.
If we can pin down a series you worked on and maybe one of your favourites, talk about that.
Okay, well, it's hard to miss out the Sweeney. It got huge, massive audiences week after week after week after week, and there were 5 series.
Okay, that was Euston Films, wasn't it?
Well, that was owned by Thames, you see. And Thames was the child of ABC. It's the same people. And Lloyd Shirley ran Euston Films and handed over, because I knew that was going to be the future, and so did he, filmed TV series, not in the studio. And he handed over to a woman called Verity Lambert, who had been a production assistant in an office, and she took over Thames Television's drama department. But the big plaudits and the big audiences came from Euston Films, which was owned by Thames. And so it's the same company. And, of course, the man of vision that saw this through was Brian Tesler, marvellous director of programmes, and he knew how programmes are made. He was responsible for Sunday Night at the London Palladium when he was a younger man, and you know, he'd worked for Lou Grade, and he knew how this was done. So he had a certain amount of respect.
And well, I mean, a cop drama is a cop drama. Sweeney wasn't quite that. No. Just on its own, though, was it? It wasn't Dixon of Dock Green.
Oh, no, no. No, we got under the skin, or hoped to get under the skin, of Regan and Carter, as human beings. And we hoped, week after week, that the audience would say to itself, I wonder how I would have dealt with that. So that involved them in a way that Dixon of Dock Green type stuff, you know. I'll do the form filling tomorrow, sir. You know, doesn't get under anybody's skin, and so you go, yeah, okay. So there were people with faults. They were sometimes far too violent with the villains. They took too many risks with the car chases, and we had to make them more and more and more dangerous, until in the end, the only stunt arranger that I cared about turned out to be a great friend of mine, Peter Braham. But I got him into the BBC on my last show. It was a show called Target. I wanted to call it The Stitch, because the regional crime squads are known by hardened criminals as the Stitch Squads. They stitch you up to get you into prison. They lie in court, The Stitch. But, of course, the BBC didn't understand that, and so they called it Target. Oh, yes, we're going to target people, yes. Okay, well, I might do that. I argued against it, but there you are. I lost. I brought in Patrick Moher to play Hackett. It was the nearest I could get away with a different word, which is a different two words, actually, something it. And that's, they didn't realise it, but I did it. And I wrote the first episode, etc. By that time, I'd already written quite a few things for Thames and Houston. And it did pretty well. They did two series of it only, and, okay, I didn't work on the second series at all, because I had other things going on.
Okay, so this is the $64,000 question. What makes a good drama? What is it that actually makes a good drama? Because I see so much drama now. It looks wooden. It looks uninteresting, unexciting. I don't feel that there's anybody on the screen that I really want to spend time with. You know, I think a lot of it is, it feels to me as if it's people acting out some, you know, it looks too much like drama, like acting, rather than it doesn't draw me in. So what draws people in?
It's a combination of things, all aiming in the same direction. I mentioned it briefly just now. It's, for me, the one guiding influence that makes any television drama, well, perhaps even on the stage, but I think I haven't done that, on the screen, the one big thing is you want the audience to get into the main characters. In some cases, it's a sole character. Clint Eastwood did it. In other cases, it's Regan and Carter, or it's Bodie and Doyle in The Professionals. And what you want the audience to do is say, this is the ideal. Wow, there, but for the grace of God, go I. If you can get the audience to do that, you've won, because they're involved in it, and they want to see you next week.
Just the one pilot. It makes three fellas and the girl. You take the fellas, I'll take the girl. Cheers. What's that?
Don't know.
So what happened to the cocaine?
Could be a swap.
What now?
What do you think?
Well, the message was for us to wait until the cavalry gets here.
Well, it could be away by then, George.
Well, you're the governor, I suppose.
That's right.
We're making for the barn. Come on.
So that's an episode of The Sweeney we finished up with there. Reagan and Carter, the idea really being that to get under the skin of these characters. That episode called Nightmare was actually directed by David Wicks. Mark Martin, he's really talking there about really, I mean, particularly these nasty techniques used in Hollywood, people sitting around waiting for you to make mistakes because they didn't really want you to direct the film in the first place, and playing tricks on you in order to try and, you know, they're obviously, the audience is the last thing on their mind.
Well, I mean, I'm not really qualified to make a strong statement about anything to do with this sort of thing. I've never been involved in the production of TV or films in Hollywood, and it's interesting to hear what he's got to say, but, you know,
I'll give you a chance to comment. But anyway, I mean, certainly for me, this is a part of the cultural decline that we've seen, a deliberate cultural decline in almost all media in the last 20, 30 years, particularly, I mean, for example, back in the early 1990s, we had some of the very last decent documentaries done by the BBC, which were actually they were commissioned by Time Watch, but they weren't actually made by the BBC, and we haven't seen a lot since then on mainstream television, either in terms of, you know, serious documentary programmes or dramas that have really started, you know, challenged the orthodoxy of the time. So, for example, a political drama like The Edge of Darkness, 1980s. A lot of people were writing this stuff for television and for film at that time. Probably the last one I've seen was the film Official Secrets about the Catherine Gunn affair, where she exposed the United States attempts to fix a vote at the United Nations in the run-up to the Iraq War. And that film, it gets its dramatic tension from the attempts to actually get it in the newspaper and to whether or not The Observer is actually going to print this stuff. Nowadays, I would suggest that, you know, there's so many of these new, I mean, we have a similar thing with the Jimmy Savile, the attempts by Miles Goslett to get the Jimmy Savile story into the national press completely failed. Even Private Eye turned him down. So what we've seen is right across the board in the whole media, a dumbing down effectively and a destruction of what was actually quite a thriving industry in the 1970s, 80s and into the 90s.
Well, I mean, there's two aspects to this, isn't there? There's documentaries and there is dramas. And
but both have gone downhill.
Well, I would suggest that documentaries certainly have, because there's been much more political control by a more determined state bureaucracy. But I mean, David Hare, the playwright, wrote in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago, or about last week, because he wrote Roadkill, which was not broadcast not that long ago, about a pushy Tory politician not unlike our lovable PM Boris Johnson. And of course, the Tories were up in arms about it, and he was basically saying in The Guardian...
Well, we had the thick of it, didn't we, as well?
Yeah, the thick of it as well, yeah. And I think the problem is that what you've got with this current government is they're determined to both police both drama and documentary. We heard at the end of Boris's speech going on about, you know, attacking our institutions and all the rest of it. That's what the 60s and all the rest of it was all about. The Beatles and all the rest of it. Hey, Bungalow Bill and all the rest of it. That's what he's alluding to.
That's what John Lennon was talking about, you know, most of his songs, including On Camera, is about the insanity of war and this sort of thing, basically being run by a bunch of maniacs. Mm. And anyway, so we're going to hear a bit more to kick off our look at COVID. And right at the end, we'll be hearing from Professor David Miller, who's been sacked, the sociologist. But before that, some music.
Victorious. three lovely daughters. They used to come and make my bed each day. They used to come and clean my living quarters. But their mother made quite sure they didn't stay. There was Mary, she seemed cheery. There was Helen, she seemed well and truly skeptical about my qualities. There was Julie, she was truly well proportioned, but her caution brought exhaustion on my aching arteries. But I was wrong, they weren't at all impervious to the possibilities of high romance. And I sensed a certain girlish nerviness in the way they folded my pyjama pants. And I was right, for late one night, sweet little Mary, like a fairy as I lay sleeping, came a-creeping to my side. She was mine, it was divine, but we were doomed, for very soon into the room came Sister Helen, and she cried. Mary go to bed, off Mary went. Now, young man, Julie said, for your punishment, we mustn't have a fight, we mustn't make a row, turn off the light. It's my turn now. Well, after all, I'm young and relatively vigorous, and though I still protest my innocence, my temperament, I'm strictly unpolygamous, and if I sinned, I sinned in self-defense. Nevertheless, I must confess, I wouldn't miss that sort of bliss. And when it ended, I was rendered comatose, when loud and clear, very near in my ear, a loud voice spoke, and I was awoken from my post-coital doze. Helen go to bed, Helen went away. Now, young man, Julie said, you will have to pay. Blighted Helen's charms, filched her purity. Open up your arms, come and filch me. I was amazed and really rather tired. I thought I'd given all that I could give. A little kip was all that I desired. But I'm British, so my upper lip was stiff. She was chaotic, idiotic, quite exotic, and ecstatic, acrobatic, and emphatically fine. All to no good, for when I could open my eyes, to my surprise, I found her mother looking into mine. Julie gone to bed. Julie left the scene. Now listen, Ma, I said, I know the old routine. I'll do what you like, but I shall be vexed, and I'll bloody well go on strike if Grandma's next.
Okay, so that's from 1970, The Lodger, Jake Thackeray. Before that, The Doors from 1968, Strange Days, and Immortal, Invisible, God Only Wise is our hymn of the week. Martin, we're going to go back now to COVID. Anything you particularly want to say? Because we're going to hear from David Wicks, who we just heard from as the director, one of the directors of The Sweeney and several Hollywood films, to hear what he's got to say about COVID. But is there anything you'd like to say this week about how way things are going?
Well, I don't think there's much point. I'd rather hear what they've got to say.
Nothing leaps out to you then. Okay, well, let's hear from David then. Because I thought I'd drop in at the end, just a question of what he made of what's been going on. And I was quite surprised at the answer that he gave. And so, here it is.
Living in a quiet little country town like this one is to be relatively safe, because everybody wears, at the height of it, wore masks, and everybody obeyed the social distancing, and everybody signed up for a vaccine and then a second vaccine, and it was all very nice, and we didn't have too many lunches and parties and so on and so forth, and nobody shook hands anymore, and oh dear, and the kids were off school and tiddly-poo. But you know, I've looked at some figures fairly recently. There's a way of saying, in the press and the government too, And, of course, the civil servants, and, of course, academia, and, of course, the media, yes. They're saying how many thousands upon thousands of something called cases. Cases? Well, to me, as a funny old bloke, a case means that you're in hospital and you're really serious. And there are wards full of people all going, that's cases. It's not so at all. What cases means is that someone has tested positive for an antibody. A what body? Antibody, which attacks the coronavirus. Well, that's good, isn't it? Oh, no, it's cases. So today, in Lincolnshire, you know, we've had 19,000 cases. I wish they... See, what they really want to say is 19 million cases. Or if they could say it to the world, 19 billion cases. And maybe in the universe it's 19 trillion cases. Well, hold on, really. What are these cases? They're not dying or anything, are they? And many of the hospitals... All through my life I've heard that the National Health Service is on the point of collapse. I've heard it every year. I heard it in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and I'm hearing it again. That's without COVID. Now, of course, they have collapsed, and they are burning down to the ground, and everybody's leaving and going, and there's only one thing to do with this country, and that's to sink it beneath the waves and forget it. Right. This is exaggerative stuff. Beyond reason. This is crazy. What are they talking about? 19,000 what cases? Well, how many deaths? 109. Well, how many of those had comorbidities? What? And in America, it's even worse. A bloke has a motor accident and dies of injuries to his head. And if they can say he had antibodies, he's down as a COVID death. But he didn't die of COVID, he died of a broken head. I mean, hello? And this goes on in America. I'm not saying it happens here as badly as that, but it does in America. I've seen several articles about it. They're signed by reasonable medical professionals who come from the Mayo Clinic and are epidemiologists. And
okay, so what's going on then?
I think the thing that goes on all over the place, I think it's power. I think there's a kind of person who gets up every morning and wants to tell people what to do. And that sort of person may merely be telling you not to park your car on their driveway, or they may turn into Adolf Hitler. There's an awful lot of difference between the two, but the motivation is much the same. You do what I tell you, because I'm superior in my knowledge and understanding, you see.
So that's David Wicks there, speaking to me last week. He is a Hollywood director, former Thames and Euston Films director, has worked for the BBC as well back in the 1970s and 1980s. But his most recent Hollywood films are just literally two or three years ago. And he is really saying that he thinks this is about power, Martin, nothing else, just power.
Well, I mean, the opinions he expressed are widely expressed, as you know, and we discuss this every week. And, you know, it's what people are entitled to their opinions. But as you say, he's a TV and film director and he's got his views. But it's not really, I mean, that's not really a medical opinion, is it?
No, it's not a medical opinion, no. But it's a perfectly reasonable opinion and it makes a lot of sense to me. Anyway, so Neil Oliver, he's someone that we used to see on our TV screens quite a lot. He's now in this kind of ghetto called GBTV, but he's still saying some interesting stuff. He thinks that at the moment that the government are starting to get afraid, that the masses have rumbled, that the whole COVID thing, pretty much from start to finish, and this attempt to get everyone injected with a potentially lethal experimental vaccine, that the public are rumbling it.
There's fear in the air. There's no mistaking it. It's made all the more noticeable by the fact Britain has never, not in my memory at least, been a fearful place. And for the longest time, the British have not been a fearful people. I remember unrest and discontent, of course I do. I remember righteous anger, but I don't remember the smell of fear. I see the strongest smell of fear, not just here, but elsewhere in countries of the developed West, is emanating not from the ordinary people, but from the leaders. Leaders of governments, leaders of giant corporations. There are plenty of frightened citizens as well, masked up and isolated, driven to distraction by months, now years, of mismanagement, misinformation and propaganda, all of it combining to create a wearying, debilitating sense of constant anxiety and uncertainty. But the strongest smell of fear comes not from those at the bottom of the pile, rather from those at the top. And what are they so frightened of, these governments and leaders? I'll tell you what, they're frightened of their own people. They're frightened of us, and there are a lot of us. It wasn't until the first decade of the 19th century that the population of the world reached a billion. It took another century and a quarter after that milestone for the headcount to double to 2 billion, and then just 30 years to get to 3 billion. It's estimated that now we're adding an extra billion people every 15 years or so. There are 8 billion of us now, more people alive at once than ever before. More people means more and more pressure on all the things worth having. Not just toilet paper and diesel, but freedom and space in which to live and roam. While the many queue and squabble over loo roll and gas for the tank, because that's where the mainstream media is goading us to look, the leaders tell us our troubles are all our own fault anyway. Brexit breaking supply chains, our lifestyles making the planet too hot. All they need is more of our time, they bleat. More of our cooperation. More of our money. Just more. But as the line goes in the outlaw Josie Wales, don't pee down my back and tell me it's raining. As well as the leaders, the billionaire elites are fearful too. Billionaires are adding billions to their wealth, not by the decade, but with every week and month of the present crisis. I can imagine it might be frightening to have so much when so many beyond the castle walls have so little or nothing at all, not even hope. I think of a technocrat billionaire and in my mind's eye I get an image of a cat being carried through the crowds on a busy city street inside one of those plastic crates you see in airports, looking out at us through the grill with fearful, uncomprehending eyes. With great wealth comes great anxiety, apparently. As well as fearing the people, like the leaders do, I think those billionaires don't much like us either. We're like ants and wasps, spoiling what might otherwise be a lovely picnic just for them. Our small lives are petty concerns. Rent, mortgages, health and education are beneath them. More importantly, our lives are made so different by circumstances, we're becoming increasingly incomprehensible to them. There are two groups to watch. Those with everything to lose and those with nothing to lose. Leaders feeling backed into a corner by the great unwashed often seek safety by demanding and then taking more and more control, for our own good, of course. From the beginning, emperors have felt safest when as many people as possible are kneeling down or lying flat on their faces so they might be walked over. It's hard for a person to defend him or herself from a kneeling position or prone, far less fight. Fearful leaders need insulation between themselves and the people and so prefer to hoard everything of value, food, resources, wealth, so they might dole out the crumbs. There's already talk of an end to money as we have known it, to be replaced by something virtual and digital you can neither see nor touch. Imagine a world where it's not you that decides how much of your money you can spend on beer or meat or a holiday, but an algorithm making that decision for you. For your own good. Fear makes the fearful lash out. Australia makes for shocking viewing right now. Black clad enforcers dressed and armed more like stormtroopers than police and beating citizens with sticks, firing rubber bullets at them, kicking and kneeing them while they lie pinned and helpless on the ground, men throttling women My family and I spent time in Australia. My kids went to school there and learned and sang the national anthem of those days. I clearly remember the line, "Australians all let us rejoice, for we are young and free." Not so much now, apparently. Is Australia the canary in the coal mine, the weather vane showing which way the wind is blowing? Your guess is as good as mine. What we have now is an unholy alliance between fearful leaders and contemptuous billionaire technocrats. Together they have the tools to take all and keep all. Never in the field of human relations has so much been taken from so many by so few. I say the best leaders are those the people barely notice, those who, without fanfare or hope of immortality, defend freedom and let people go about their business unmolested. Those that seek praise for their efforts are tolerable too, as long as they keep the lights on at the same time as preening for the cameras. The leaders the people and then history do not forgive are those that make themselves feared and then despised. Remember at all times that your life is your own, and your hopes and dreams weigh the same as those of any emperor or billionaire. They're frightened. You can smell it. It smells like victory. Hold the line.
So that's Neil Oliver on GB News, really saying that what he thinks is that there's a quite corrosive atmosphere in government at the moment, where they're aware that there is a mass of people. I suppose, really, summing up what he's saying, it's the sort of thing that we've been talking about here, Martin, for years, really, which is particularly since the Russians have blocked the plans for the Anglo-Zionist Empire in Syria. Militarily, that the oligarchy seems to have turned their fevered brow on the domestic population. So the idea is that, well, we can't beat these people abroad, but we can certainly beat anybody that says anything nice about them at home.
Well, that was a kind of well-written presentation, but of course he wasn't taking any questions there, was he? He seems to think that the billionaires are anxious. I don't think they're anxious. I think they're arrogant. They think that they're winning. And when he mentioned the Australian national anthem there, "We are young and free," that is about to be changed, because, of course, the Aboriginal population say, "Hang on a minute, Australia is the oldest inhabited area of the planet. And your young, free, created Australia was dumped on us at our expense." And, you know, the police in Australia beating people, well, that goes on all over the world, Tony. In India, in South America, in Colombia, people are murdered.
Okay, well, we can see where you're coming from. That's okay then, Martin, isn't it?
No, it's not okay. I'm just pointing out what's going on here is a rather privileged slice of Western public opinion have suddenly woken up to the fact that capitalism is a brutal, fascistic system. And they're suddenly saying, "But we thought it wasn't anything like that." If you live in Colombia,
well,
the dogs in the street
exactly
know
what I was
that 9/11 was carried out as an inside job. Did Oliver talk about any of that?
This is surely aware that this is actually reflecting exactly what I said, which is that the oligarchy is now turning its ire on the domestic populations.
That's right. There's a showdown happening all over the world. Apart from, exactly, for example, in China, where they've eliminated COVID and they're preparing for World War III without the police beating people with truncheons to keep them in their houses because they don't have to. And I think this is fundamental.
Lucky China is the land of the free, isn't it?
Yeah, lucky China that was probably given a biological warfare attack by the very same billionaires that he's pointing the finger at. But he's not going to full hog, is he? The billionaires probably created COVID, tried to seed it inside China, and the Chinese military are very well aware
of it.
We're
actually going to come to that in a minute.
Yeah, that's what we need to talk about.
There's been some fascinating revelations by the Daily Mail this week about that. But before we do, I thought it would be fascinating to look at this Nudge unit. And there was a terrific... The Pandemic podcast has been chugging along. I'm trying to think, Dan Astin Gregory has been doing this podcast right since the start of this, and he's interviewed some fascinating people who, I mean, really by subscribing to that podcast, and obviously this one too, what you can do is you can hear all those voices that are being shut out by the London media, by the mainstream Western media generally, apart from parts of the Murdoch empire. That's things like Talk Radio, Fox News Australia, Sky News Australia, which Murdoch still owns, and Fox in the US have been doing some really good investigations into the origins that we were just talking about there of COVID as a potential bioweapon. But anyway, this pandemic podcast, particularly fascinating, was this Belgian, what he is, a clinical psychologist, and he's been looking very much at the way that the people like these nudge units have been maneuvering, getting under the skin of the population, getting into people's unconscious, and actually controlling vast numbers, thousands or millions of people, using the mass media.
The mathematical models that had most impact on the corona measures were probably those issued by Imperial College in London. And these models actually predicted that by the end of May 2020, in a country like Sweden, about 80,000 people would die if the country would not go into lockdown. And the country did not go into lockdown. And by the end of May 2020, the virus claimed about 6,000 people in Sweden, and no more than that, which meant that the models actually overestimated the mortality of the virus by a factor of 15, and so, which is huge. And the strangest thing for me was that while the corona measures actually present themselves as measures that are really scientifically based, that are based on mathematical modeling and stuff, the strangest thing is that at the moment it was proven beyond doubt that the initial models overestimated the dangerousness of the virus dramatically, the measures and the approach was not corrected. It just continued as it just continued as in the beginning. And at that moment for me, that was like a turning point for me, I think. I started to take a different perspective then. I switched then from the perspective of a statistician to the perspective of a clinical psychologist. And I started to wonder, like how is it possible that an entire society, even the world population, is going along with a narrative that shows so many absurd characteristics. Another example of an absurd characteristic of the story was that from the beginning of the crisis, institutions such as the United Nations actually warned us that probably more people would die as a cause of starvation or hunger in developing countries because of the lockdowns than the number of victims the coronavirus could claim, even if no measures were taken at all. So, which meant as much as that the remedy was far worse than the disease in this case. And then still, nobody seemed to notice, and everybody seemed to be focused so much on these corona victims and on the possible damage caused by the coronavirus. That everybody continued, and that people continued to be willing to buy into the story and to go along with the story, which is actually extremely strange. From then on, from May 2020 on, I started to try to understand what psychological processes were going on in society. And it took me about 3 or 4 months, I think. It was in August 2020, because I suddenly felt that I could really hit the nail and that I could say, what you're dealing with here is a process of large-scale mass formation. That's what's happening. And looking back, it really surprised me that it took me so long, because I had been lecturing on mass formation for 4 years at Ghent University. But at that moment, I had a feeling like, yeah, that's what's going on. And I also could really show how exactly this process had been emerging in our society, and how it provoked the effects that it had in our society.
Brilliant. Can I ask you to very briefly define what mass formation is? Can you summarize?
Yes, mass formation is a specific phenomenon which emerges in a society if a few conditions are met. So there are at least 4 conditions that have to be fulfilled before a large-scale phenomenon of mass formation can emerge. And the first and most important condition is that there should be a lack of people experiencing a lack of social bond, a lack of social connectedness. The second condition is that there have to be a lot of people who experience a lack of meaning making. And these two are actually associated to each other. People are human. Humans are social beings, and if they experience a lack of social connectedness, a lack of social bond, they will probably also experience a lack of meaning making. And then the third condition is that there have to be a lot of people who experience a lot of free-floating anxiety. This means anxiety that is not connected to a mental representation. For instance, if you see a lion and you're scared, then you know what you're scared of. Your anxiety in that case is connected to a mental representation. But if it is not connected to a mental representation, you end up in an extremely aversive, negative emotional state in which you deal with a kind of anxiety that you cannot control. So, first condition, lack of social bond. Second condition, lack of meaning-making or sense-making in life. The third condition, a lot of free-floating anxiety and psychological discontent. And then the fourth condition, a lack of free-floating frustration and aggression, a kind of aggression that is that you feel inside of yourself, but that you cannot direct or aim at a certain object or cause. So, and then...
No, just stop that for a second, because I think there's a better term for that. It's angst. So the idea that you're afraid of something, but you're not quite sure what it is, angst seems to me to be the correct word to be using.
When these conditions are met, something really typical can happen in a society. When under these conditions, a narrative is distributed through the mass media, indicating an object of anxiety, and at the same time providing a strategy to deal with this object of anxiety, then there might be a huge willingness in the population to go along, to participate in the strategy. And why? Because all this free-floating anxiety, which is so hard to control, connects to this object of anxiety. And in this way, that's the first advantage. All this free-floating anxiety is now connected to a mental representation. And then, just by participating in the strategy, you can mentally control the object of anxiety. For instance, if a narrative is distributed which says that there is a very dangerous virus and that we should go into lockdown, if these four conditions are met, then there might be an extremely extraordinary willingness to participate in the strategy and the lockdowns, even when the narrative in itself is absolutely absurd. So, and what happens is actually something very important. When people start to participate all together in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, a new kind of social bond and a new kind of meaning-making emerges, which means that there is like a new kind of solidarity that emerges. And this makes that people switch from a highly aversive, negative mental state of social isolation, interpersonal isolation, to the exact opposite, to the extremely high level of connectedness that exists in a crowd or a mass. So, and then people start a heroic battle with the object of anxiety, which leads to a kind of mental intoxication of connectedness, which is the real reason why people continue to buy into the narrative, even if it's utterly absurd or blatantly wrong. Okay. It's a kind of a ritual. It's a kind of a ritual. It has exactly the same function as a ritual. A ritual is a kind of behavior that people participate in to show that they belong to a group, to create a group, to create a collective, to create solidarity. And you can even say about rituals that the more absurd they are from a practical perspective, the better they function as a ritual. Of course, because then the more absurd they are, the more purely they become a sign that shows that they belong to a group.
So that's clinical psychologist Professor Matthias Desmet there from Ghent University in Belgium. He's saying it's a kind of spell being cast. That's what he goes on to say. But this whole idea of the creation of fear, which is difficult to put your finger on exactly where that fear is coming from, it's very similar to Naomi Klein's shock doctrine.
It is, and of course there's been plenty of disaster capitalism around this pandemic, or plandemic as some people call it, but of course it is a plandemic. I would suggest that it's a planned epidemic. In other words, it does exist. And it was in a biological warfare attack on China.
I don't think anyone is suggesting it doesn't exist, are they? They're suggesting there that it's been exaggerated. For example, you know, as he says, there were warnings of 80,000 deaths in Sweden. That actually only translated into the reality was 6,000.
Yeah, and then because there was a limited lockdown in Sweden, there wasn't no lockdown. And, of course, lots of people voluntarily, because that's the Swedish way, did the right thing without being told to do it. And, of course, in Sweden, because it's a welfare state quite unlike our own, if, you, for example, you show symptoms and you go home, the state will pay 100% of your wages.
Anyway, Dan Astin Gregory's done a superb job with this pandemic podcast. Happy to plug away, you know, for him. This whole idea of mass formation, it's the hive mindset predicated on untruths and lies that respond to psychological needs. Now, you know, this does remind me rather of the September the 11th attacks. And, oh gosh, you know, America's under attack. America has got to respond, you know. And there was a whole narrative that sprung out of the amazing kind of TV pictures on September the 11th, 2001.
Indeed, but of course an enemy was definitely identified. It wasn't a general angst about society. It was Muslim extremists of Al-Qaeda, which of course, as pointed out at the time, were put in business by our own special forces and intelligence services, like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And the obvious question to ask is, what role did our intelligence services play in 9/11? And we should ask the question, what role do our intelligence services play in this plandemic? And I would suggest to you that the evidence is piling up that this is a deliberate attempt to control global society. But of course, it didn't work in communist China, which is at least a quarter of humanity. And therefore, we're moving now into the war phase, not the psychological war phase, the war phase, which follows the initial contact with the enemy.
Anyway, hats off to the Daily Mail. I could even echo the comments of the leader of the Birmingham Mosque when we were up there, if you can remember his name, Martin.
Let's escape me now, because you've just put me on the spot.
He's not with us anymore, no, but he was fantastic.
Dr. Nassim.
Yeah, that's right, Dr. Nassim. And he, as he said, God bless the Daily Mail about the 7/7 London bombings, because it was revealing all sorts of stuff which proved that the official narrative 7/7 simply wasn't true, such as the train that the bombers were supposed to have caught didn't run that day, things like this. But anyway, there's quite a lot. That's a whole can of worms, 7/7. But this week, the Daily Mail have come out with Wuhan scientists and US researchers planned to create a new coronavirus in 2018. A consortium led by a British guy called Dr. Peter Daszak asked DARPA to fund research at the lab in the city where the COVID pandemic began. They go on, a 2018 grant proposal sought to combine data from similar strains to create a new virus. It was submitted by scientists from the US, China and Singapore, but it was rejected. A genetics expert from the World Health Organization told the Daily Telegraph that such work could explain why a close ancestor of a COVID-19 has yet to be found in nature, which is a very polite way of saying that it's been cooked up in a lab, isn't it? And finally, the Wuhan Institute of Virology are consistently denied creating COVID-19. Well, they're covering their backside there at the Daily Mail. But Martin, this is pretty, you know, it should be a news all over the world, shouldn't it? As the COVID has had such a powerful effect that the scientists and American researchers from China and the United States, plus this Brit, were all cooking up a new coronavirus in 2018, or at least doing everything they could to do it, putting out research proposals and trying to drag in money. This particular proposal failed, but one assumes that they got their money elsewhere.
Well, DARPA, of course, is part of the Pentagon, and they were certainly carrying out research into coronaviruses. We know this. And the Wuhan Institute of Virology was supposedly a joint venture between the Chinese and Western partners to look into things like SARS-CoV-1 and so on. Now, what the right wing who are pushing this in the West fail to understand is that it's not an accidental leak from the Wuhan virology lab. And, of course, there's lots of evidence that the Chinese are now putting forward.
Well, I think they may, Martin, I think people may, you know, be not able to make those sorts of accusations. But, you know, the fact that they're at least going there now and saying that this could be a bioweapon is, oh, and it leaked out by accident. In a way, that is a sort of backhanded compliment to those people like us who are saying, well, it was deliberate, because it's difficult to accuse them in the mainstream media, because they're some of these people are rather powerful. They would get sued.
Well, what's happening in China, if you follow what's going on in Global Times, which is their major English language mouthpiece, is they're saying, right, let's talk about the origins. We think this comes from Fort Detrick. And of course, they haven't really been pushing this too much to begin with, because they're trying to keep a low profile.
Well, this article is talking about Wuhan, not Fort Detrick.
Yeah, so, but the DARPA, which funded this, is part of the Pentagon. And it was the University of North Carolina, which is where the SARS-CoV virus came from. Now, this is a can of worms. This is why the right wing, the Murdoch press in Australia, etc., were being warned off going down this road at some months ago. Because what will come out of this is that this is a deliberate attack on China. The timing at Wuhan was perfect, just before Chinese New Year. And if the Chinese hadn't jumped on it in the way they did, their economy would have been trashed. But they didn't. That didn't happen.
Bilderberger of the week. I keep getting these emails from Robin at WikiSpooks talking about there are Bilderbergers all over this. They're now up to 75 of the major figures in the Western world who are playing key roles in the rollout of the vaccine program, for example, and in the media too, who are ex-Bilderbergers. But yet we're not supposed to think or talk about Bilderberg anymore. It's disappeared. It's gone away. It certainly seems to me that this organisation has achieved its goals since its first meetings in the mid-1950s, and it's now got its place people in all over the Western world who are rolling out a globalist agenda, or, New World Order, effectively. That's what they're up to. But anyway, the other article this week, it really does indicate what you are saying just then, Martin. What are they hiding? This is the Mail on Sunday, an excellent investigation by Ian Birrell. At the start of COVID, many scientists believe it likely it leaked from a Wuhan lab, until a conference call with Patrick Vallance changed their minds. We asked for his emails about the call, and this is what we got. Well, the Mail on Sunday published a double-page spread about this last weekend, everything is redacted. The question is, I think it's Alex Craner that put this out on social media, so what are they doing? Redacting public health information. This is key to actually understanding what's been going on with COVID and also preventing it happening again. Massive redaction, so there's hardly a single word that you can read. And this is from the Government Office of SAGE, and particularly Patrick Vallance from the Wellcome Trust. They're basically covering this whole thing up. What happened was, they initially said, oh, this looks like a lab leak, and then they obviously got together and had some sort of conflag and decided, no, it's not a lab leak, we're going to tell the world it's come from a bat.
It's not probably a lab leak either. It's a deliberate attempt to wreck the Chinese economy. Don't forget, the military games took place in Wuhan some weeks before the first viruses were detected. The Chinese are pointing the finger to that. And they're saying that the trainees for the military games actually trained just down the road from Fort Detrick, which was closed for some reason in July of 2019. In September of 2019, as one of our audience sent an email to us about this, the banks collapsed, and Vanguard and BlackRock, who you mentioned earlier, took over the roles of being the economics department, the State Department, Department of the Treasury, and the Federal Reserve. Just before, in November, the Israeli Defense Forces were told by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States, according to the Times of Israel, that a pandemic was coming out of China. This all implies that the Defense Intelligence of the United States, Agency of the United States, had foreknowledge of this pandemic. And of course, if it is a biological warfare attack, not just on the Chinese, they're quite happy to attack everybody else as well, because that allows them to carry out their disaster capitalism plan, which of course has been carried out outside China. This all suggests that in actual fact, this has to be taken seriously. And the idea that we had people who made the Sweeney earlier saying, well, it's all just made up.
Martin, he didn't say that, did he?
He was saying it's all
because
about
he doesn't
cases.
Agree with you. Yes, actually, it has become about cases.
No, so that, for, what for, caused for lockdowns in this country, so. It was about the death rate going up. the government was unwilling to lock down.
But he's not talking about
so.
That at all. You see, you're just misrepresenting what he said, and which is rather cheap.
No, we're talking about biological warfare here, which is a viral biological warfare agent. Now, in Russia, Putin spoke at the Valdai Club, which is one of their big sort of think tank meetings that they had some months ago. And what he said about this is people who think that we and the Chinese are working with the West to get everybody vaccinated because of the COVID crisis are away with the fairies. We are struggling to cope with this. The Chinese have coped with it better than we have. And we've got our own vaccines, nothing to do with Western Big Pharma. We don't trust them. The Iranians were saying, we think that this is a biological warfare attack. Like, that is what the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is on the record as saying. I mean, you work for Press TV, you should know this. And of course, this is the person who took over from Soleimani. That's what the Iranian, Chinese and Russian general staff believe. This is a biological warfare attack. And that's why they've taken various measures to deal with it.
But it's a biological warfare attack on us as
it's
well.
A biological warfare attack on the whole of humanity.
And also it's been massively exaggerated, as we were saying earlier.
In Brazil, where Bolsonaro said in line with Trump that we're not going to do anything about the virus, it's just a flu. What's happened there, they've had a massive, massive deaths all across Brazil.
Well, they
should
be using ivermectin.
Well, you
they?
May say so, Tony, yeah, but will. in actual fact, what's happened
anyway,
in Brazil
can we
is Bolsonaro
back,
is
Martin,
now on the back foot. They're thinking of a military coup.
Can we just get back to this conference, teleconference that Sage had? Because that's actually what we're trying to talk about here.
Is it?
Tony Blair. Yes, it is. It's this Mail on Sunday revelation about the discussions at Sage about trying to bamboozle the public and the government into thinking that this wasn't didn't come from a lab, that actually it was all it all came from a bat, and it's quite clear that these
Well, it did come from a bat by a lab.
It wasn't a naturally made thing. So I'll just read out from this article here. Just a couple of paragraphs. Surely the origins of the pandemic, an event that has caused such disruption and misery to so many billions, is of utmost public interest, even if the implications might be profound for our relations with China or the unfettered pursuit of science. The pivotal role of this teleconference on the 1st of February 2020 emerged from emails obtained in the US in a recent book on the pandemic by Farrar. 2 days before the call, The WHO had belatedly raised the alert level on the unfolding public health disaster. The discussion was convened after Fauci, America's chief presidential medical advisor, was sent an article from Science magazine examining how researchers were attempting to unravel the virus origins. The article, which Fauci hastily sent to other key officials, discussed controversies over risky gain-of-function research, manipulating viruses in labs to make them more infectious, and it detailed work by British scientist Peter Daszak and his friend Professor Shi, that's Batwoman, over in Wuhan, in sampling bats and finding new coronaviruses. The teleconference was led by Farrar, an expert on infectious diseases, who admits that he saw the huge coincidence of a novel coronavirus erupting in a city with a super lab that was home to an almost unrivaled collection of bat viruses. So this is absolutely key to understanding what went on here, is at that point, these experts, particularly led by Farrar from the Wellcome Trust, decided that they were going to tell government and the public the opposite of what they actually believed, which was that this virus had actually been cooked up in Wuhan or somewhere else and brought to Wuhan and released from there.
Yes, and I'm very interested to look into this. And of course, if we are going to go down this road, the Chinese have already flagged up what they're going to do in relation to this. They think that this is a deliberate attack on them and the rest of humanity. And if we're going to go down that road, let's talk. I mean, 9/11 was a deliberate attack. And of course, the foreknowledge that the DIA had, which they passed to the Israelis, implies that the perpetrators are inside the US deep state. And it's not the Chinese by accident creating coronaviruses. It's a deliberate creation of a coronavirus virus by the deep state in the West. And they hoped by releasing it in Wuhan just before Chinese New Year. If you look at where Wuhan is, it's right at the center of the Chinese network of roads and railways.
So I spoke earlier this week to Sonia Elijah, who's an investigative journalist, and about an article, because I think there's a fascinating aspect to all of this is obviously, you know, this coronavirus wouldn't necessarily have led to a mass vaccine rollout, but it seems that someone somewhere or a whole bunch of people decided that it was going that the in fact, we heard from the start, didn't we, on the mass media, that the vaccine was our only hope. Well, of course, it wasn't our only hope. Chemicals, treatments like hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine and ivermectin are extremely good at treating COVID in the early stages. In fact, some countries even had little vehicles in the major cities going around to anybody that started getting symptoms and dishing them out a dose of ivermectin to stop them going into hospital. And the rough average of the different surveys of ivermectin show something like 80% of people who would have gone into hospital don't, because they've been given some ivermectin anyway. The glorious BBC this week came out with an absolutely appalling article saying, oh, ivermectin is just a horse dewormer. And so I spoke to Sonia Elijah earlier this week about what she made of this particular article, which is actually looks to me like pure disinformation in order to try and scare people that they're not supposed to look at the fact that there is a treatment, a perfectly reasonable treatment for SARS-CoV-2. And actually, this treatment may be far better than actually having a vaccine. So the vaccine companies have got to put, the big pharmaceutical industry have got to put a lot of effort and time into trying to make sure that any idea that people might want or take ivermectin or chloroquine is squashed, so that everyone has to take their vaccines and their wonderful $200 billion annual industry starts to grow.
This is disinformation. This is how I would classify it as. I would say the 90% of this piece is full of unsubstantiated claims. They're not providing any solid evidence. They are relying solely on this group of sort of scientists, independent scientists, they're calling them, but it's the same group of people. It's Jack Lawrence. It's Gideon Meyeritz Katz, and then you've got James Heathers, Nick Brown, and you've got Kyle Sheldrick. So when you look at all the various sort of articles on different platforms, they always go to the same sort of group of five scientists. Now, what's interesting is that you know, I looked into their sort of, you know, I just did some research. I was looking who they are. And for example, let's just take Jack Lawrence. He is currently studying for his master's in biomedical sciences. Now, what's interesting is that this piece and also the Guardian piece, which was the sort of July, I believe it was a July 15th Guardian piece, where they write him as a med, they write him down, they classify him as a sort of medical student. Well, he's studying for his master's in biomedical sciences. That's one. Secondly, he is a blogger. He's a journalist. Well, he's a journalist. He's founded a website called grifter.news. And when I was looking through the website, it is literally set up. Its primary aim is to sort of debunk or counter the so-called disinformation coming from the journalist Tim Pool, who he classifies as a right-wing YouTuber. So it's just sort of like an unusual website, but that's sort of the premise of it. Anyway, so you have this Jack Lawrence character. You have him saying that what I'm referring to now is the El Ghazar study, which this is a study done in Egypt. And apparently Jack Lawrence, as part of his class assignment during, you know, at sort of, I guess he's at St. George's University, his professor gave him the El Ghazar study to look for fraud in, to find fraud. So that's the sort of the premise, that's how it starts. And he uncovers apparently lots of plagiarism, and he then reaches out to Gideon Meyeritz Katz in Australia, and the two of them then reach out to Nick Brown, and they literally go through all the, apparently go through all the data. They essentially hack in, because Lawrence admits trying to attempt to hack into the to access the data, the raw data apparently, and he managed to get in and hack in. So he's sort of admitting on one hand that he actually is kind of committing an illegal activity here. I don't think it's normal to sort of hack into scientists' password-protected data. So you've got that. So it's sort of,
well, hang on, because it's actually quite important to be able to get at the raw data. If you're critiquing a study, you know, as a journalist or as a blogger or, you know, whatever for the BBC, if he's got access to that raw data and it doesn't really reflect what's written about in the conclusions of the study, then surely that is a legitimate piece of investigative journalism itself.
But you have the author, Dr. Ahmed Elgazar, saying on record that it wasn't the data that, that he's being present, that, that that Lawrence supposedly found. He's saying that's not my data. That is not my raw data. They've added two extra columns. You know, they've literally manipulated his data. So it's sort of, you have kind of a bit of hearsay going on. You've got one side saying something, you've got the other group saying something else. So it needs to be investigated independently, which it is. It's currently going under, it's an ongoing investigation.
So that's Sonia Elijah. They're talking about this BBC article, including actually a Guardian article from July, with this group of people, one of whom is actually a medical scientist. The rest of them are either students or not medical scientists, who are saying that these ivermectin studies have been massaged. But the key point that Sonia has teased out here, Martin, is that the these people seem to be working with a completely different raw data set than the original scientist Ahmed Elgazar, who prepared this report on ivermectin. And he's saying, actually, this is not the data that I work with. And we've got an article on the BBC, we've got also this article in the Guardian saying that, oh, they've massaged the figures, but they're basing that on a different data set, at least according to the origin. So it seems to me a quite a complicated a rather sophisticated attempt to smear this guy. It wouldn't be the first time that we'd seen manufactured reports about things like chloroquine and ivermectin.
Well, as you know, there's an awful lot of people saying an awful lot of contradictory things about what's been happening, about various potential cures and vaccines and so on and so forth.
There is no real doubt about the use of ivermectin and chloroquine. These are two substances which, if they're taken in the early stages of COVID, if they were taken, could be very effective. Anything between 40 and 90% of people are helped in order to deal with this. These are long-term drugs. It's a serendipitous effect, although these drugs both have been used against parasites. They both happen to help the body to defend against viruses and stop it replicating inside their body. So and this is one of the problems with SARS-CoV-2, is it replicates very fast and can take over people's bodies almost. I mean, obviously it's concentrated in certain cells, but this enables the body, gives the body a bit of a head start in order to deal with it, and it can be very effective, as we've seen in many of these studies. The BBC simply don't like it for one reason, and in fact it's Big Pharma that don't like it, using the BBC to bamboozle people, because the idea that there is a treatment, an alternative treatment to the vaccines, would make people maybe more hesitant about taking a vaccine, an experimental vaccine, particularly if they're a child.
Yes, but I come back to the fact that the Chinese have got their own vaccine, Sinopharm, which actually wasn't that effective, apparently. The Russians developed their own vaccine, Sputnik, and it's not just about vaccines, it's about Big Pharma. But Big Pharma don't rule the roost in China and in Russia. And this is actually warfare we're talking about here, not medical arguments.
Well, it's a medical, kind of medical tyranny, I think. But what we've
it's
got,
a tyranny.
What we've got there is, you know, really just lies being put out by the BBC, repeated from these individuals. And there's no, for example, they talk about Dr. Tess Laurie, who's just down the road from us here in Bath, as some sort of crank, but she's actually been working for many years, doing this thing called the evidence-based medicine consultancy, challenging Big Pharma and putting out reports to the World Health Organization, the National Health Service, etc., which challenge the sorts of conclusions that the pharmaceutical industry are coming to. So, you know, there is an enormous amount of money goes into selling various drugs to the health service, and what Tess has been doing for many years now is to be trying to find even just small surveys that challenge the pharmaceutical industry. So it's not surprising that the pharmaceutical industry, via the BBC, BBC is trying to smear her. Anyway, one of the key things at the moment is this whole business of vaccinating children. And I spoke to Dr. Stanley Laham about this just yesterday, really just asking him. He's a immunologist, retired from Florida, about this whole idea of vaccinating children who are very, very unlikely, unless they have some sort of other comorbidity, to even stand a chance of being hospitalised by COVID-19. And yet there's attempts to put two vaccines into their arms, plus obviously a booster jab too, to someone that isn't actually vulnerable to the disease.
I was also vaccinated, you know, with the Sabine vaccine, which is the live polio vaccine. But now I would not feel good with the way Big Pharma, and we're talking about vaccines who were developed by people who refused to patent them, who said that the patent, you know, belongs to humanity. So there was no $1 billion to be made. Now, giving this mRNA vaccine to children, I find particularly alarming. One of the first concerns I had from the beginning when I first heard about mRNA vaccines back in March of 2020, I wrote about the dangers, the possible side effects of an mRNA vaccine. And one of them was that we also, you know, the mRNA is supposed to be taken up by our cells and translated into the viral protein, which migrates to the cellular membrane. But we also have another enzyme in our system called reverse transcriptase, which can reverse transcribe this mRNA into DNA. And that DNA may be inserted into plasmids, eventually into our genetic makeup, into the genetic, into the chromosome of some of the cells that do get absorbed that mRNA. Now, in children, that's particularly alarming because children are developing new cells. And for example, the master immunologic organ is the thymus. Now, the thymus, by the time you're 20, is atrophied. But during childhood, during adolescence, and even during embryogenesis, it's the master immunological organ that determines self versus non-self, that makes you make you know, attack things that are not part of your embryogenesis as you were developing from a baby, you know, from a fertilized egg to a baby and throughout adolescence. And with this mRNA vaccine, I can just imagine if some thymic cells, which are not active in adults, but very active in children, 2, 3, 4 year olds, would take that mRNA and reverse transcript it into DNA. I don't know for sure what the effects would be, but it cannot be good. And I don't know why they're pushing for it. Because if the adult population is vaccinated, then we have nothing to worry about. There will be, it's something they seem not to talk about when they're saying, well, let's go further down the age groups. If adults become fully vaccinated, then there should be herd immunity. If their vaccine is good, if the mRNA vaccines are good, then there would be herd immunity and children would be normally protected. So that's my concern as far as an mRNA vaccine, which is still in the experimental stage. It will take years and years before we can say for certain that it's not taken up by hepatic parenchymal cells, lung cells. We already know that people have had reaction like pericarditis and myocarditis from it. And there's only one explanation for that, is that The myocardium was presenting viral antigen, which caused an inflammatory response. So that mRNA, which I postulated since it spoke about it, would not remain locally at the site of injection, obviously makes its way to other organs. And that would
can you just explain what myocarditis and pericarditis is?
Inflammation of the heart muscles and inflammation of the pericardium that envelopes the heart. Okay, here's something that we all know about. I suppose that the rheumatic heart fever. Rheumatic heart fever is when the heart muscles present streptococcus antigen. Therefore, it's very important that people who suffer from rheumatic heart fever not get streptococcal infection or a streptococcal vaccine, which would cause, you know, a severe bout of rheumatic heart fever. And if not treated in time, cause death. It's a question of and now hospitals are on the lookout for it. There has been many, your listeners can look it up. There have been enough cases for hospitals to be on the lookout for myocarditis and pericarditis caused by the vaccine. The Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. And like I said, the only way that this can happen is if these organs are producing viral antigen and causing an inflammatory response, which means that the mRNA, there is no guarantee that the mRNA that's injected in the deltoid muscle in your arm will remain there. Some will inevitably get injured and be absorbed by other cells. Now, whether the effect will be nefarious was a question that was up in the air. But the fact that we're getting, you know, these cases of myocarditis as a direct result of vaccination sort of proves the point. As far as the liver is concerned, as far as liver reactions, we may see them, but these will take longer time. You see, the liver is not, you get heart inflammation, you may know it right away. You get liver inflammation, you may not know it until 1 or 2 years or 3 years later.
Now, I suppose the obvious question is, we're now 10 months into this big experiment. Apparently, the experiment of these emergency use authorization vaccines is going to be finished in 2023, which is in another 2 years' time. But we're 10 months into this now. What are your thoughts about how well that experiment is going?
You know, we're living in a society where information is totally controlled, as opposed to the way what I was used to in the end of the 20th century, in the 1970s and 80s. It's difficult to say how that experiment is going because we're getting, doctored results. From time to time, we hear about the big snafus of that experiment. But then it's immediately covered up by, an onslaught of main media, mainstream media, great benefits of the vaccine. If you're in the United States and you're watching the late night shows, you know, something like ivermectin, which, you know, has proven beneficial in the treatment of COVID-19, has proven very beneficial in the treatment of COVID-19, unlike the remdesivir fiasco. You hear them talking about it here, and they call off some crazy people are taking a horse dewormer, and yet the elaborators, the people who elaborated ivermectin as a medication, got the Nobel Prize for it, and ivermectin was put in the list of medications, essential for humanity, of it, just like hydroxychloroquine, which has saved millions and millions and millions of lives from malaria.
So that's Stanley Laham there, giving a summary at the beginning of his problems with whether to use these mRNA vaccines with children, but also saying, Martin, that, you know, it's going to be years down the line before we really know what the effects of these vaccines are. He's also talking about really debunking this idea that the mRNA vaccines cannot change your DNA. He's saying using this stuff called reverse transcriptase, this is a definite possibility, and particularly in children, because their bodies are still growing, and there's all sorts of changes going on. Their cells are still reproducing, and as they are, these mRNA vaccines could be being incorporated into their DNA.
Yeah, I think the question marks over Pfizer's mRNA vaccines are the biggest ones, because they are a for-profit company, absolutely unashamedly so. And, of course, countries like South Africa and India were basically lobbying for the patents which Big Pharma in the West operates round to be waived, because there is a plandemic, pandemic, whatever you want to call it, and therefore it should be in everybody's interest for people to share whatever breakthroughs they've made, so that people can then work for free to try and deal with the pandemic. But that was blocked by, amongst others, the British government. And of course, we heard Boris in the first part of the show bloviating on about how our vaccine rollout was a very great success of Brexit. And as you will know, Tony, the vast majority of the British population have already had two vaccines.
But let me just say something about Pfizer, because it's easy to forget that that is a criminal company. They were already shown to be a criminal company back in the 1990s in Nigeria, and the families that they destroyed and the children that they killed, Pfizer killed, took 15 years for them to actually get justice in the Nigerian courts. Incredibly, part of the trials that they were doing on a meningitis vaccine down in Nigeria, a large slice of the money for those trials, Martin, was set aside to bribe Nigerian officials, and also to fight any attempt to get the challenge of this vaccination program into the courts.
That's right. I mean, it's not surprising that people are suspicious of companies like Pfizer and Moderna. Even AstraZeneca have pretended that they're doing a not-for-profit rollout of their vaccine, but they're keeping the patent, and after the pandemic has gone away, they're going to try and monetize what they've done, and they've actually made quite a lot of money already. But I come back to the point that Sinopharm and the Sputnik vaccines in Russia and the four different vaccines which have been developed by the Cubans are all traditional vaccine technology. And what's actually happening in the developing world is that the Russians, the Chinese and the Cubans are saying, don't bother with their stuff, come and have our stuff for free or cost.
Anyway, Nigerian government sued Pfizer successfully for $7 billion over these illegal tests. They were basically conning people, completely conning individuals into taking a vaccine that they didn't need, this anti-meningitis drug.
Yeah, I mean, the constant garden of the book and the film by John le Carré shows the way in which Big Pharma operates in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world. They are definitely, you know, bad actors, and it's not surprising that people are very suspicious of them.
Okay,
but I still come back to the point that it isn't just about them.
Let's have a listen to a very short summary by Stanley Laham, and I'll put the full interview with him up on our show page, as usual, up at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. But he summarises quite nicely here.
Many countries who have used antivirals instead of the vaccine. Well, it's very simple. The country that developed the vaccines the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine is the United States, and the United States has the greatest number of deaths per 100,000 than any other country in the world. So let's just leave it at that.
Dr. Stanley Laham there, summarising the wonderful success of the US mRNA vaccines.
Well, their whole approach to COVID is not just the vaccine, is it? I mean, as you pointed out the other week, the Chinese have actually seen a fall in their death rate per 100,000. And that wasn't to do with vaccines at all. They didn't use any.
Okay, so the last doctor we're going to be hearing from is Dr. Peter McCulloch, where he talks tonight about what he calls therapeutic nihilism. And I like to hear the use of this word nihilism, because what it really implies is that the proponents of whatever it is, it's a sort of group think that, you know, where certain people take a particular attitude. It's kind of criminogenic. It's rather like the idea that, well, you're going to put forward any point of view, so long as you've got exposure to the press, you're not going to get arrested for all sorts of reasons. And you've actually got absolutely no morals. I think to myself of the guy who's what was his name, he's in the government at the moment, Martin, who was the chair of Le Cercle, which is this right wing, very right. Would you know what the Cercle is? The Pinay Circle.
Yeah, the Pinay Circle I know of. Yes,
which is,
well, it's basically the people in Britain before World War II who were very sympathetic to the Nazis. And they still exist, of course.
They do. And one of the chair up until recently was Nadim Zahawi, who was the vaccine rollout minister. He's now, I think, the business secretary. So interesting to think that people who were so sympathetic to the Nazis are now, or that organisation is now having someone like him as their chair. So I see these people as nihilists, people who actually make a living and success out of going on to TV and having the brass neck to defend absolutely the indefensible, which I see him doing week after week on Question Time. And what with the chairmanship on the BBC Question Time of Fiona Bruce, nothing really ever gets asked of him. You know, like back in the day when people like Dimbleby or it was the other guy that used to do it.
Robin Day,
yeah. You would get difficult questions for people like him, but no, it's all just sort of silly jokes that go out now. Very convenient for people like the Conservative Party, having people like him on there. But anyway, let's have a listen now to this. I just like this idea of therapeutic nihilism as he talks about vaccine safety, Dr. Peter McCulloch.
The adenoviral vector DNA vaccines, Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, use a replication-incompetent virion to inject DNA into the cells, and that DNA transcribes messenger RNA, or the Pfizer Moderna is messenger RNA into the cell, again, directly involved in protein synthesis. So it basically interacts with ribosomes, and then we have transfer RNA that assembles amino acids into proteins. But what's the protein that's being assembled? In red here, the protein is the spike protein. 1,200 amino acids loaded, as is correctly pointed out by so many presenters, it is a deadly protein. By itself, it is a deadly protein. It's a deadly protein. It's the first time in human medicine where we are injecting vaccines and we're asking the human body to make a potentially lethal protein. The hope is we'd make a small enough amount of it and it would create just enough of an immune test that we'd form immunity to this deadly protein. The gamble was, what if we make too much? What if we make it for too long a period of time? What if these lipid nanoparticles go to the wrong organs and don't stay in the arm, and we start to produce this lethal protein, this damaging protein that's expressed on cell surfaces? It's not supposed to be there. The body immediately recognizes it, attacks it as being foreign. It breaks free in the circulation, circulates for 2 weeks, as shown by Ogata and colleagues from Harvard, and then damages blood vessels, probably the pericytes, maybe the endothelial cells, clearly is related to thrombosis. It's related to what's called hemagglutination because it attaches to salic acid residues on red blood cells and creates an unusual form of clotting, particularly in the lungs, causing desaturation like we've never seen in any other viral infection. This is what we're doing to the human body with these vaccines. It is unprecedented that this is being done. It's also unprecedented that millions of Americans, more than half of us, have volunteered to take the injection without asking too much about how it works. People in my family did. They did it patriotically. They were asked unquestionably to take the vaccine, and it didn't matter which one. It didn't matter which one. And so here we are today with over half of Americans, a smaller fraction of the world's populations, have taken one of these vaccines. There's other ones. There's the Sinovac vaccine, which is a killed virus vaccine, far less effective, also has problems. There's 27 of these in development. But this idea was that the vaccine was the only way that we were going to get out of this pandemic. It alarmed all of us. By May, this paper, 57 authors, 17 countries, Bruno and colleagues, I'm in the author block, basically said, listen, if we don't have safety mechanisms in place for the vaccine programs, shut them down. Shut them down, because it's safety, safety, safety. Our concerns was this was a dangerous mechanism of action. We had skipped all the critical testing to understand what this is going to do long-term to the human body. We had a concerning biodistribution study from Japan showing hyperconcentration of the lipid nanoparticles in the ovaries. Moderna separately had shown a reduced fertility study to the EMA that was concerning, not to the threshold to kill the program. There's been no external advisory committees, no human ethics committees, day safety monitoring board. The FDA and the CDC are the sponsors of the program. They cannot be the adjudicators of death. They cannot. That violates every regulatory law that we know. And the CDC and FDA and the NIH work for us. They are public servants to us. They do not issue rulings to us. They don't have authorities to issue rulings to us. They should serve us. The doctor and the patient sit in the fiduciary relationship above those three entities. And we have the authority to make that claim. Very important. Authority is a very important word. They excluded, they should have excluded patients who were excluded from the clinical trials. Exclusions were agreed upon by the FDA and all the IRBs because they knew the vaccines weren't going to work or would cause excessive harm in pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, COVID recovered, those with suspected COVID and positive serologies. Under no circumstances should a human being have ever taken one of these vaccines because they weren't allowed in clinical trials. Full stop. Full stop. Very, very important. There was no effort to restrict these people from the vaccine program. In fact, they were encouraged to take the vaccines with no safety data, and very importantly, no efforts to risk mitigate.
Well, he's quite subdued applause there. He's talking to a medical audience. That's Dr. Peter McCullough in the US there, making a very important point at the end. I mean, saying all sorts of interesting stuff about the effects of the Pfizer and Moderna, how it actually works. But it does seem, you know, kind of bizarre, doesn't it? There was a whole bunch of people that weren't involved in the original clinical trials of these vaccines. They were excluded from the trials, including children, pregnant women, etc. But once the emergency use authorization had been signed to use these vaccines, absolutely everybody, including kids, is involved, even though they didn't take part in trials, including pregnant women. And we've had, there was figures a few weeks ago for loads of extra miscarriages that women are having as a result, and that's because they weren't involved in the original trials of these vaccines.
Well, as you know, I mean, everybody's pretty much aware that these are experimental vaccines, and the way, you know, at the Tory party conference, Boris was geeing up the faithful by saying because of Brexit, we were able to vaccinate everybody that much quicker. And of course, if we're going to argue about what people, you know, democracy and 50% plus one vote, the majority of people in Britain have already taken one of these vaccines. Now, it may well be that the vaccines are going to cause problems, and people were kind of aware of that. But ultimately, the problem is that the mechanisms for dealing with all of this crisis have cruelly exposed which countries are better organized and which countries are not. And of course, that's not the United States of America, which has got an absolutely dysfunctional healthcare system based on for-profit considerations. And that's why they are up against something like the Chinese system, where they don't have a for-profit medicine at all.
Our situation in the UK is we are basically doing what the pharmaceutical industry want, as well as the US.
Well, maybe we are, but in actual fact, that's a battle that's already lost, Tony, because a majority of people in this country have already been vaccinated. And if we're all going to die from it, then it's too late.
No one's saying like that. You're exaggerating again. Martin, you're exaggerating again. I don't think anyone's saying they're all going to die from it. That's just a silly thing to say.
But the point
it's
I'm,
a silly little thing
no, the
to
point
say,
I'm
it?
Making, Tony, is that the battle to stop people who are going to be vaccinated being vaccinated, from your point of view, is lost. I've already had two vaccines, so does virtually everybody else I know.
But it's not a battle, actually, to stop people having it. It's a discussion about why people have had it.
Yeah, people are welcoming
it. That's just the way you frame these things.
No, but what I find problematic, Tony, is if I'm perfectly willing to listen to arguments about vaccines, but I'm fed up of being beaten over the head about lockdowns. Now, if the vaccines are dangerous and the virus is dangerous, maybe we'll have to adopt non-vaccine measures to control...
Like ivermectin.
Or proper lockdowns and test and trace. They didn't use any ivermectin in China, did they? They carried out test and trace and they locked it out.
By the way, just been hearing about all the psychological effects of these things that you seem to so love.
Mm-hmm. The psychological warfare effect of this is clear. If this is a biological warfare attack, a bigger attack on humanity than 9/11, then of course everybody's got to recognise that that's what it is, and steps will have to be taken to protect humanity. In China, they have squashed COVID without ivermectin.
Oh, they haven't, because they keep having to have extra lockdowns, in New Zealand.
Yes, but
they haven't.
But their economy,
Total myth you keep peddling on here, that COVID has been completely squashed.
No, it hasn't been completely squashed, because they've had 5,000 deaths.
Don't say it then. Because they have to keep going back into lockdowns.
Well, we may have to go back into lockdown if these vaccines turn out to be useless, it may well be the case that these vaccines aren't dangerous, but they don't work.
We have a choice between using these hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin or having
most
lockdowns.
People did not that know is, about hydroxychloroquine
well, the French
or
government
ivermectin.
Did as you yeah. know in that Pepe Escobar yeah. article oh, but the I, French government I come back withdrew to my Martin the French government withdrew hydroxychloroquine back in January 2020 to make sure that nobody could get any.
I come back to my fundamental point that one quarter of humanity in China have crushed COVID without ivermectin or vaccines. And they've done it right.
Well, they haven't crushed it at all.
No, all right.
They're coming back with more lockdowns over there.
Yeah, there have
because
been.
Because there's been outbreaks.
Yes, and what they do is they lock down local area and trace everybody. That's what they do every time.
Yeah,
because it's a biological warfare agent, and that's what you got
to
do.
The only way to really beat it is through herd immunity, where people have got.
So you've been pushing this line of herd immunity from the get go. So it's a biological warfare agent, but we've just got to let it run.
No, I didn't say that, did I?
But that's what you mean by herd immunity.
No, I don't. I mean using ivermectin and allowing people to get it.
All right. So, okay, so we've now developed your position as a humanities graduate, ivermectin and let everybody get it.
No, as a journalist, just interviewing doctors who know about these things. But you've interviewed a certain sort of doctor.
If this was under Ofcom rules, under BCFM, you would have to have doctors on here in your clips who didn't agree with those doctors.
Well, you've been having you putting those points of view. I'm just a political activist, Tony. Interview these other doctors, I'm putting those opposite points of view to them to tease out what they're saying, which is actually fine under Ofcom rules.
Okay.
If you're trying to undermine
I'm just pointing out you won't accept
you don't seem to know what the Ofcom rules are.
Okay, I'm just coming back to what a general point. I come back to it because you keep evading it. The Chinese have controlled this biological warfare attack without ivermectin and without vaccines. They are now vaccinating their people with Sinopharm. But they took their time because they wanted to check that it was going to work and they wanted to check that it wasn't dangerous.
Well, as we just
and they
heard
didn't
from there,
have to rush.
The Sinopharm vaccine may not be as effective anyway.
That's right.
Anyway, so we'll leave that little discussion about the Sinopharm and whether it works or not for another day. The quite clear evidence from what we've seen in this part of the world is that the variants seem to be able to find it quite easily to get round these vaccines, whereas it's not at all so easy to get round herd immunity, natural immunity that people have built up. Somebody who believes that it's not a good idea to have a vaccine is a guy called Dr. Aaron Carity at the University of California. In fact, he's so irate about being told that he has to get the vaccine to continue in his job at the university, he's now taking them to court, saying, well, no, I don't think you should do that. And so as a result, he has been suspended. So let's have a listen to what he has to say about what he thinks is this new feudal system that's emerging.
As a psychiatrist, I've seen things in the clinic that I had not seen prior to 2020, the effects on people of the lockdowns, on their mental health, on their physical health, the effects people who were consuming large quantities of the news, watching CNN for more hours than they should, and the rhetoric, the imagery, the tone of reporting on COVID and on the pandemic very often was designed deliberately. This is not conspiratorial. It's quite well known now to induce fear as a way of influencing people's behavior. So several people have written about what's sometimes called the Nudge Unit in Great Britain, which officially consults with the British government and also consults with many institutions in the United States. This is a behavioral science group that looks at how do you alter people's behavior. And one of the conclusions of their report was we sort of need to increase the level of fear around the pandemic if people are going to take it seriously and if people are going to do the things that they need to do to mitigate COVID. And, you know, one can think about that from a very narrow public health perspective as, you know, it's important for people to stay home or wear masks or physically distance from one another or take the vaccine. But if you sort of Google Earth up from that very narrow perspective and you look at what's the overall impact on people's lives and on their physical health and on their mental health of using fear and using inflammatory rhetoric and dire images to try to influence people's behavior, it's not good. And so I'm really glad we're having this conversation. Back in October, I wrote a piece in the Public Discourse that I called The Other Pandemic, which was the lockdown mental health crisis, the effect on people's mental health, on depression, anxiety, substance use.
So that's Dr. Aaron Cariati, who's been suspended from his job at the University of California. He's looking at a little bit like the previous guy, the clinical psychologist, looking at the way that the media has been abused in order to bamboozle people and put people into a state of fear. But Martin, him being suspended, this is becoming kind of almost the norm now. We've been talking for years on and off about people coming up with controversial views, like Anthony, or oh gosh, what was his second name? The Canadian 9/11 guy, Tony. I can't remember his name, but anyway, he was he wrote a book.
Hall, isn't it?
Tony Hall. That's right. One of the Canadian universities being suspended for literally having something posted onto his Facebook wall by somebody else. The idea is, of course, that there's a massive amount of bullying going on in academia. And the idea is that the people who are the stables of experts around the world have got to have a specific view now, that this whole idea of critical thinking is out. And if you've got a different point of view, but anyway, that is quite clearly happening here in Bristol this week with the sacking of Professor David Miller. Now, I've known David for probably 15 years or so, maybe more, after going up to do a seminar with his students up at Strathclyde University in Glasgow when he was up there. He then came a bit closer down. He moved down to Bath University and then into Bristol, where he's had his legs chopped off or his tongue cut out by the Bristol University staff, the leaders of the Bristol University. Now, this is really about Palestine, isn't it? I think that's the key issue. Somebody who supports Palestine is not allowed to be an academic, it seems, in Britain.
Well, as you know, he's going to appeal this decision. And no doubt in the interview that you've done with him, he will explain what's actually going on in the case. I think there is always going to be a potential problem with academic discourse, and, you know, what are the parameters of it, who gets to speak and what under what authority. And, you know, there is, you know, the whole area is policed in various ways, because in a sense it has to be policed. Otherwise anybody could just claim to be anything, couldn't they?
But well, of course, I think it's a bit more than that.
No,
it's also
in his particular case, it's definitely political persecution.
Well, it is. And, I mean, there are various lines that as academics you can't cross. For example, you can't be a racist, can you?
Well, in theory, you can come out with ideas that some people might call racist, but as long as you've done your research and you can stand up your arguments, then you're allowed to have a point of view, in theory. And of course, that just depends. I mean, the argument is that against David Miller, put forward by the Jewish Society in Bristol University, is that they feel unsafe going into Bristol University while he's there. Now, that, I think, really stinks. There's nothing wrong with a Jewish society existing at the university, the Union of Jewish Students, and they've got an openly pro-Israel platform. That's what they believe in. They believe that the state of Israel is basically a good thing and everybody should support it. I haven't got a problem with that. But the problem is that you can't turn around to another professor, probably in a different department from you, and say we don't like his views, we feel threatened by them. And at the same time, we've got a Tory government which is saying that universities and student unions can be sued if they prevent racist speaking, because everybody's got to have a voice. But at the same time, David Miller, he's got to go because the Jewish students at Bristol University feel frightened. There's even a Tory MP saying it's like the 1930s in Nazi Germany. And it's like, that's a bit of an exaggeration, don't you think?
Well, it's fascinating, I think, what the University of Bristol said last weekend, which is that they fired Professor David Miller after a years-long campaign of smears by the Israel lobby. The university said on Friday that Professor David Miller is no longer employed by the University of Bristol. The statement said only that Miller did not meet the standards of behaviour we expect from our staff, although it would not elaborate. So this is the university just saying we've sacked him, but we're not going to tell you why.
Well, the other thing is that there was an investigation carried out by an independent investigator, and I'm sure it'll be in the interview that you've done, and they concluded that the case of anti-Semitism, there was no case to answer. So Bristol University have now fallen back on, but we can just decide we don't like you because we don't like you. That's what it boils down to. And, of course, he's going to appeal this, and it's going to end up in an employment tribunal.
Miller said that the decision to fire him was taken under pressure from the Israel lobby. So anyway, let's hear from David Miller himself, an exclusive interview I did with him. This is just a clip from it. This is about 9 minutes long, but there's a longer 25-minute interview I'll be putting up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the full interview later tonight.
This is a part of the ongoing assault on academic freedom, which we see in this country and in other countries in the Western world, by powerful forces. In this particular case, it's an attack which has come from Israel. It's directed by the Israeli government, and to do that, it coordinates with Zionist organizations throughout the world. The Union of Jewish Students, I should hasten to point out, is not an organization which just represents Jews. It doesn't represent all Jews. Anti-Zionists find it very difficult to join and are often hounded out of the UJS. The UJS is explicitly, by constitution, a pro-Israel organization. And that is the problem with this. The campaign against me was initiated not by students in the beginning, but by a pro-Israel organization. And when that organization had its complaint rejected because it wasn't a student, they contacted and encouraged the students to make a manifestly hopeless complaint about me, which was subsequently dismissed. And then in February this year, there was a confected outrage about comments I'd made mentioning the fact of the previous complaint and comments I'd made about Zionism. And that has had the effect of having me sacked. Now, the confected outrage was confected by student groups on campus, but also by a whole range of pro-Israel and Zionist organizations, the Board of Deputies of British Jews, the Jewish Leadership Council, the Community Security Trust, the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Anti-Semitism, which, of course, as many of your listeners will know, is funded by Zionist individuals and foundations. And so there was a confection of the idea that I was anti-Semitic. I've been routinely defamed as anti-Semitic. I'm not. I'm a lifelong anti-racist. And what we see here is the same process now affecting the universities as has affected the Labour Party. The campaign to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn is part of the same effort. And they now have switched their attention. Now they've got now they've captured the Labour Party, as moralist everybody knows. They're now intent on capturing the universities. And they've come for me first. But they are also currently pursuing cases in Warwick, in Glasgow, in Leeds, and in other places too, which many people won't be aware of. And we will see much more of this in the coming period. They're doing the same kind of thing in the States and have done the same kind of thing in other countries like France and Germany. So this is an international campaign by, let me put it this way, by a hostile foreign state, i.e. Israel. And the sooner we recognise that and take measures to counteract it, the better. And just to finish on that, I mean, if you want to look at at an analysis of that campaign, look at the diaries of Alan Duncan, who was a minister who the Israelis had tried to have removed from being a minister as a result of his moderately pro-Palestine politics. I mean, he makes it very clear that there's an entrenched foreign espionage campaign against those who in this country will speak out for Palestinian rights. And, you know, we have to recognize that or it will continue to be successful.
Well, you talk about Israel as a hostile foreign state. Actually, no, they're one of our closest allies. In fact, many people say that the Five Eyes intelligence sharing agreement has got a little clause in there where actually we are sharing our highest levels of intelligence with the Israeli signals intelligence people, the Israeli intelligence too. So, no, they're not a hostile state. They're actually one of our closest allies.
They're one of our closest allies, which also routinely plots to remove politicians, elected politicians, including conservative ones, who don't meet their requirements. So, I mean, that's the kind of hostile state we're talking about.
The university talk about their duty of care to their students and that you are being removed as part of that duty of care because they've got to look after their students. But actually, looking at the statistics, they have one of the highest suicide rates of their students in the country.
That's true, and that is very worrying. And if one was to look at that a little bit closer, that might be something which is journalistically profitable. I mean, I think that the other question, of course, is not just the duty of care to students, but the duty of care to staff. I mean, they have failed in their duty of care to me, most obviously. But when my colleagues in the university signed letters in support of me or tweeted in support of me, they have been subject to a deluge of trolling and threats for them to lose their jobs. And the university has done very little to defend them against that. And let me also say that these complaints first started in April 2019, so, you know, 3 years ago. The complaints were made in relation to a lecture I gave on Islamophobia. So the objection they made was that I referred to parts of the Zionist movement as being engaged in helping to foment Islamophobia and prejudice and racism against Muslims. And that is a fact. And the problem with that, of course, is that it means that Muslim students, Arab students and Palestinian students on campus find it difficult to raise issues about racism against them in case they are accused of being anti-Semitic.
Now, you mentioned Jeremy Corbyn, but really, this is kind of the reasons that he's been suspended from the Labour Party, the reasons that Ken Livingstone were. All the kernel of this is this kind of contradiction between Jewishness, the state of Israel, and Zionism. Can you just unpick all that for us? I know it's a big question, but, you know, how is it that these three words, the Zionist movement, which is behind the creation of the State of Israel over, you know, more than a century, and the fact that someone may be have chosen a religion or have been born into a religion of faith, and also this ethnic thing of because Jewishness is not just a religion, it's also an ethnic thing, David.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, the State of Israel was created through force of arms and through what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, whereby 750,000 of Palestinian indigenous people were forced out to create the State of Israel. And that process of ethnic cleansing is something which continues today. It continued with the invasion and occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, of the Golan Heights, etc. in 67. And it continues today, as we all saw in May this year, with the ongoing colonization of Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan by settlers. So what we see there is a political project to colonize and to settle Palestine, which they call Israel. And that's not the same thing as being Jewish, right? There are many, many thousands of Jews who are opposed to that project and who are opposed to the occupation and the human rights abuses that necessarily come with Israeli state's existence and function. So this is not to do with Jews. There are many, many Jews who are anti-Zionist, many of whom have supported me. And indeed, there are many Christians who are actually also Zionists. The largest proportion of Zionists in the world really is likely Christians, especially in the US, Christian Zionists. So this is not about the Jews or about anti-Semitism. It's about the actions of a particular state in a particular historical period, and the historical period is now. And what we see in Israel is ongoing ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. And if people speak up for that, then they are denounced as being anti-Semitic. Now, the reason for that is because the Israelis know that their activity and actions are deeply, deeply unpopular. And you saw that with even within the Labour Party the other week at its conference, where a really quite militant motion on Israel as an apartheid state was passed. And so the Israelis need to do something to counteract the hostility that their actions cause. And what one of their strategies, one of their weapons of choice, is to say people who are anti-Zionist or who stick up for the Palestinians or stick up for Palestinian rights are just anti-Semitic. And that's because the state of Israel is the Jewish state. And if you're hostile to Israel, then you're hostile to the Jews in general. Now, of course, that's an argument which is absurd, but which nevertheless is at the heart of the Zionist movement's arguments. And that's the kind of arguments they deployed against me, that when I talk about Israel, what I really mean is the Jews. Well, no, I don't. Everybody can see that there's a distinction between being racist against Jews and being critical of the Israeli state and its policies, actions, and even its formation. So that's my potted guide to the distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. But it really cannot be allowed to stand. If we allow it to stand that there is no distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, what we're saying is that the colonization and ethnic cleansing of Palestine will continue until there are no Palestinians left there.
Well, that's sociology professor David Miller from, up till last week, the sociology here at Bristol University. I can't help but thinking that he has been accused of being a conspiracy theorist. I most definitely am, and I quite enjoy exercising my imagination on what may have happened there, is that these other universities would never have done what Bristol University have done, and he's been sort of shuffled around the sociology world and invited here into Bristol for a few years to chop his legs off, Martin.
Well, I think that he's been very brave and outspoken in his views for many years, and he's very highly respected within the sociology world. And Bristol University is one of the top universities in the country, according to all of the metrics that they use.
Now, he points out in much of his analysis that the threat of Muslim terrorism or Islamist terrorism is actually far, far less than it's portrayed by the media. And also that there is an enormous bias in the press in order to try and inflate the real threat of Islamic terror. And the other thing, of course, is that the Israel lobby actually does manufacture terrorism. It does false flag attacks and this sort of thing. Certainly the Israeli state, the Mossad, do this sort of thing in order to really get this conflict between them and the Israel and Islamic countries like Iran, get the conflict going. They seem to want to actually to create conflict in order to try and benefit from it.
Well, one of the five Israelis that were arrested after filming the first plane hitting the World Trade Center 20 years ago said to the police, according to the Bergen Record, which is the local newspaper in that part of New York, to the police, he said, "Oh, your problem isn't us, your problem is the Palestinians." That's what he said, even though, in actual fact, he'd been caught red-handed with his colleagues, who turned out to be Mossad agents, because that's what they said on TV in Israel, filming the very first plane hitting the World Trade Center, which implies that they had foreknowledge, just as the fact that the Israelis were given foreknowledge by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the pandemic coming out of China in November 2019. The Israeli state is a small state with a small population, but they punch way above their weight, and they are very, very involved in violence and have been from the get-go. So the USS Liberty in 1967, which is a US spy ship, was attacked by the Israeli Air Force. They hoped to wipe it out completely and blame the Egyptians. In the 50s, the Lavon affair, there were bomb attacks on Western targets inside Egypt, and when the Egyptian police arrested those concerned, it turned out they were claiming that they were Islamist extremists. Okay, well, they turned out to be Mossad
agents.
But
I think the real nub of this is this connection to the Jews, because obviously, you know, if you're seen to be criticising Jews, then quite rightly people are going to be very annoyed about that. They might accuse you, for example, of being a Nazi. So... This does sort of remind me of the Knights Templar, because we had back in medieval times, didn't we? We had a force which called itself Christian, but it was charging through the Middle East, chopping everybody's heads off without really a kind of Christian moral amongst the many hundreds of people who were part of these crusades. So there's something sort of similar, I think, going on today to what was happening back in medieval times, with people using faith and religion, whether it be Christian or Jewish, for their own political goals.
Well, I mean, there's manipulation of religion and there's genuine fanaticism, and both are possible.
Just finishing on David Miller now, one of the articles from Spiked Online, an appalling article actually about this, but it says, like many academics obsessed with conspiracy theories, David Miller is inevitably drawn towards those that involve the hidden hand of Jewish organisations. Well, like the Mossad.
Not so hidden.
No.
I mean, they've been out front saying that we want this guy sacked, so it's not really a conspiracy in that sense, is it?
Indeed, Miller's academic identity is defined by his hatred of Israel, which he perceives as the principal threat to world peace. It says he has even accused Israel of trying to impose its will all over the world.
Well, the fact is that the Mossad people themselves, in that book that came out some years ago, Rise Up and Kill First, they boast about the fact that they manipulate politics all over the world. And then they say, oh, that's anti-Semitic when you accuse us of manipulating politics all over the world, even though we've got a book here where all of our Mossad agents actually boast about manipulating politics all over the world.
Now, on this anti-Semitic issue, there's Shulam Aloni, the former education minister in Israel, as well as Viktor Ostrovsky, who was a Mossad katzer, wrote some terrific, if anyone is interested in the Mossad, Ostrovsky's books are really an incredible explanation of what really goes on amongst these, including sex parties at Mossad headquarters and things like this. Fascinating to see what really goes on with these unaccountable intelligence services. But he also said that they just use anti-Semitism as a trick to smear people with.
Well, that's pretty clear, isn't it? And ultimately, I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, and for my sins, I kind of supported NATO intervention over Kosovo. I bitterly regret that now, but at the time it seemed like the best thing to do. But I tell you who didn't support that, and that was the Israeli government at the time, led by Ariel Sharon, because they suddenly realised that if NATO can intervene to prevent Muslims being massacred in Kosovo, then they ought to be, without UN support, then of course we could end up on the receiving end of a military campaign to force us to disgorge the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and all of the gains made by the Zionist state since 1948. Don't forget that the world recognised the Zionist state in 1948 on the basis of a very small area of land, basically contiguous to the Mediterranean Sea, which included Tel Aviv and various other places. But they immediately went to war with their neighbours and ethnically cleansed their way in further inland, very similar to what Serbia tried to do inside Yugoslavia. And, of course, the Serbs ended up being bombed for 73 days, and thousands of people, including weather girls, were incinerated. Meanwhile, of course, there is no talk whatsoever of any kind of slap on the wrist for the Israeli military, even though they continue to murder people with impunity.
Yes, shocking. Anyway, just to let you know, folks, I'm cooking up a special on climate change with some extracts from a couple of excellent documentaries, including the great global warming swindle, which was on Channel 4. All sorts of complaints to Ofcom about that, but all of the complaints were quashed, and the program's findings were upheld. Some fascinating interviews, including one with the former editor of the New Scientist magazine. I was going to try and get some of that ready for this week, but no, that's for next week. Also next week, Peter Mandelson and Stanley Johnson, a very close look at some of the power behind the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and a sound engineer, Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. To be included on my weekly email circulation list with links to many of the stories on this week's show, please email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details, plus these longer interviews, do please send me interviews and story tips too via this week. This is the show page, this week, oneword.org.uk. My book, After 30 Years of Research into the Dodgiest Ever Deals Done Between the Allies and the Nazis in the Last Months of World War II, is The Traitors of Arnhem. Also, the other book, which is out in paperback, is looks at the secret government from Cromwell to the assassination of Princess Diana. That's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. Get them on actually via Bilderberg.org and on eBay, but you can also download them as ebooks, the Siege of Heaven ebook too. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream here, except when we are restreaming the Richie Allen Show, and also on Sunday lunch at Camberley's RadioQUK.com. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information, such as about ivermectin, is sadly the norm in the UK today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. 18 months of it now, guys. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know, and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday, where we'll also have a bit from Alex Craner on the Theranos scandal. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
That's that album. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for choosing BCFM.
These days I'm walking with my head down. These days my nerves are wearing thin. Burning that candle till it's burnt out. No sign of a second wind. There's a voice in my ear, soft but so clear, saying I'm still right here. So don't you dare go giving up. Fight the good fight, even when the fight ain't fair. Keep your hopes high, even when the hope's not there. You got to steady on, hang on to Jesus. You're not done, don't stop believing. All of heaven's cheering you on to finish strong. Yeah. Our God is with us in the trenches, so we'll taste that victory in the end. Yeah. Beauty will bloom.